download. Pitchfork Festival founding director Mike Reed, songwriter and folk musician Dan Navarro, and from the Core Theater, Charlie Newell and Kate Collins. Now, here's your host, a man who is thinking about investing in a snowblower, Justin Kaufman.
Or just borrowing Rob's. What do you think? I have a feeling he'll be up for letting us all, like, the download snowblower. I feel like life would be a lot easier if I had mechanized ways to clear the sidewalks in front of me. That's what I'm going for. That's life after 40 for me. Mechanized ways to clear a path. That's where I'm going. Don't stand in my way, Chicago. That's where I'm going. I need like a Mars rover for the snow. Does that work? Hello, everybody. Justin Kaufman here. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got an outstanding show today. It's so cold outside. I don't know what the temperature is, and you know, you can get all that fancy stuff from Tom Skilling tonight, but when I just feel it in my bones, walking to the mall where that Potbelly's is at Nordstrom, it was cold. But don't worry. We got a hot show tonight, so it all works out. Coming up at 7:30 hour, we're going to talk about apologies and non-apologies on the campaign trail. The race for Illinois governor is heating up, and everybody seems to be stepping in it. So we'll talk about who stepped in it today and this week and what we can expect from it. Also, other races, including the assessor's race, heating up as well. A.D. Quigg from the Daily Line will be here to join us, talk about all that, plus other things happening in Chicago and Illinois politics. It's coming up after the 7:30 news. 8 o'clock tonight, Dan Navarro, longtime folk musician and L.A. songwriter, Hollywood songwriter. He was part of the group Loewen and Navarro for years. Eric Loewen, his partner, died tragically of ALS back in 2012. He's been on his own now for a couple years, almost a decade, being a solo artist. He's going to be at Shuba's on Friday. But what Dan is known for is he's a songwriter. He's a Hollywood songwriter. He writes songs for notable artists. His one of the biggest that he did was Pat Benatar's We Belong. We belong to the night, we belong to the sun, we belong. And others, but that's my favorite. We'll talk to Dan about his career writing music for others and, of course, going his own way. A solo act on the road coming to Shuba's on Friday. And he brought his guitar. So we'll hear some music. Also staying on the music kick, Mike Reed is a cultural advocate, I'd say a cultural leader for this city. Howard Reichs got from the Tribune, had a quote about him that was just the center of the music universe in Chicago. Mike Reed, drummer of jazz quartets. He's been in so many different acts, and his Flesh and Bone project is going to be at the Chicago Symphony coming up this Friday. But also, Mike Reed is known to many music fans as the founding director of the Pitchfork Music Festival, the huge indie rock film or music festival over on in Union Park, which is one of the most influential music festivals in the country every year. He's also on the programming board for the Chicago Jazz Festival, owns a couple of clubs in town. Mike Reed, my guest tonight, 9 o'clock. We'll talk to him about where is this city heading when it comes to arts and culture. Be a good conversation. Looking forward to that. Also tonight, Kate Collins on the program, the former star of All My Children, who was able to play not only her character, but her character's psychotic twin sister. She's a huge star back in the 80s and 90s, and she hung up her acting, I don't know what you say, your acting boots, acting cape. She hung up her acting cape. Most actors are going to have capes. She hung it up to raise a family here in Chicago, and she has been coerced out of retirement by her husband, Charlie Newell, who is the artistic director at the Court Theater, for Arthur Miller's play All My Sons. Kate Collins and Charlie Newell will be in studio tonight. We'll talk about that early Arthur Miller play. And tonight, you excited about this? Sam Panionovich, you may have heard here at WGN, the sports anchor and longtime guest to this program who comes on all the time, including big sports events that are happening around town. He is leaving WGN Radio at the end of the week. He will be in Las Vegas for his new job, but Sam will make his final appearance on the program. We're not going to let him back on the show ever again. This is it. So Sam Panionovich on the show tonight. So there you go. That's a full show, so why don't we get to it? News, weather, and traffic with my man Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon, excuse me. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break, we'll come back, and we will do the carryout, so stay with us. All right, it's The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We got a great show lined up, lots of great stuff. I was just thinking about it, Pete. We've got music. First, we got politics, we've got sports, we got theater, we got music. We got so much stuff tonight. You know what else we've got? The carryout. Here today is top stories. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi took a magic minute and turned it into an eight-hour filibuster today over immigration and the budget. The House historian says she set the record for the longest speech ever given in the House going back to 1909. Did it work? No. Of course not. She's got to be hungry, though, right? Get Nancy some of those Lady Doritos. Stat. But it was a long speech. This in response to Republicans and Senate Democrats moving forward on a two-year spending plan without addressing DACA or immigration, which I thought we were all on the same page was going to happen by February 8th. Well, Nancy's not on the same page. The reason the Senate Democrats gave in and voted for the extension was that the Senate leader promised to take up immigration as part of a new spending deal, right? But the Democrats then just said, okay, and they settled on full funding for non-military spending instead. Military is getting theirs, for sure, but the Dems put immigration aside to keep funding social services. So it would have been awesome if this could have happened, I don't know, 3 weeks ago? The president has reportedly, leak, it's a leak when you hear that, when you hear the president allegedly, reportedly, leak. The president reportedly wants the Pentagon to ready a grand military parade right down Pennsylvania Avenue to salute the president. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Salute the military. Got it. I'm down with a parade. Only if the soldiers throw Jolly Ranchers from the tanks. Or they blast techno music from the Humvees. Do you believe in love and love? Do, 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 do. Oh, it's a different type of parade? No Cher? Pumping from the Marine Corps? Ah, it's the fun of that. Local news, gubernatorial candidate J.B. Pritzker is apologizing. He was heard on the Blago tapes making disparaging remarks about possible African-American candidates to replace Obama as U.S. Senator. Not real disparaging, but light disparaging. Today, he was flanked by Jesse White and others to apologize for the remark. And also, the campaign told us that he snagged the endorsement of Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. Although, Republicans were quick to point out that he already had her endorsement from back in October. And this was just a publicity stunt for black voters to recycle her endorsement. The Pritzker campaign said, no, now it's formal. Before, she had just said it. But now, she means it. So, okay then. Elon Musk's Tesla company posted losses, big losses, the biggest in history this quarter. Which is surprising since Elon Musk has a damn car in space right now. I mean, come on, right? That's worth at least 50 local commercials and 1,000 wavy arm mascots in front of a dealership. Your car is in space. Also, the Falcon Heavy launch not only launched a car into space, but the rockets came back down and landed where they were supposed to. That's amazing. I can't get Uber to get the right GPS to my house, yet they can get rockets to land exactly where they want them. More of this, please. More of this. In weather tonight, well, we must have angered the snow gods because not only do we have two snowstorms in the last week, but another one big is reportedly on the way, could dump up to 9 inches Chicago area on Friday night, to which Northwest Indiana replied, 9 inches, lightweights. Then they, and I was trying to think of what the delicacy of Northwest Indiana would be. Then they had a pizza. It's like, yeah. So it's just now we're in flurry mode. Just hang in there, Chicago. That's all I gotta say. Hang in there, right? We're into February. We're already headlong February 7th. If we can just hunker down for a month and a half more, this winter stuff is over. And then before you know it, it'll be June, July, August, September. Then we'll just do it all over again. That's what I say right now. It's all of us all across Chicago. We just meditate on the idea. Shut our eyes together and recognize how humid it's going to be in July. We'll all complain together in July. And then when we get to July, I'll say, shut your eyes. Imagine February, how cool it's going to be. Dry. In sports, 1 week till spring training starts. And from the looks of it, the Cubs and White Sox are just going to have a pitching machine on the mound. Since the owners aren't paying for free agents, it'll be just like Little League. Joe Maddon out there lobbing balls every fourth day. yelling at Kyle Schwarber. Tuck in your shirt. Come on, hustle. Wheel of Fortune snubbed the White Sox. You see this? Puts all over Facebook. A puzzle included the names of Chicago sports teams, and they did all the big ones, but omitted the White Sox. This plus ESPN Sports omitting the Sox from the Chicago championship list back when the Cubs won it all. Really, it has White Sox fans annoyed. Come on, right? I don't know where Sox fans' shoulder chips come from. I don't know. Vanna White. And Sajak's from Chicago. He should know better. Ugh. All right. The Olympics start tomorrow. That's why I brought in my trumpet. Listen here. That hurts my lips. Although the opening ceremonies are on Friday night, seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? Because the Olympics actually start tomorrow. I believe trials start tomorrow. But I hate to be the athlete who's already out of it. He has to fake it. The athletes are here from Papua New Guinea. Oh, all right. Thanks. I'm already out of it. I wasn't fast enough on my skates. The Olympics have another time zone problem. The actual competitions are going to happen 15 hours ahead of us, and NBC will be running the events in prime time after they've already happened. We've seen this before. So if you're watching the Olympics for the thrill of the moment, you're going to have to unplug from the internet for a couple of weeks because there is no way that the news sites and social media can keep a secret, right? See the Trump White House. It's just not going to happen. Now that the Super Bowl is over, can we get to the important task of sizing up the offseason for the Bears? Draft is one thing, but free agency is going to be big for the Bears, who have over $40 million to play with in cap space, not counting all the players who will be released soon. So what do the Bears need? Looking at pass rushers, the top free agent at linebacker is Barkevious Mingo. Barkevious Mingo. Please sign him. For all of us who are fans of Key and Peele, just please sign Barkevious Mingo. Also, did you see that former Bears quarterback Shane Matthews was sentenced to 3 months in jail for a healthcare scam in Florida? I do believe jail time is appropriate for quarterbacks checking down on a 3rd-and-12, but I never thought it would happen. I was just spouting off back in 2002. Speaking of former Bears quarterbacks, maybe Jay Cutler wasn't such a bad guy. Did you see this? Since all of his bad reputation really came from asking for a trade when the Broncos turned the reins over to Josh McDaniels. Remember that? He was a petulant quarterback who didn't want to play for McDaniels, and we just thought that McDaniels was so great. Well, did you see what he did? He bolted on the Colts, McDaniels, after accepting the head coaching job. So maybe all along it was Josh McDaniels. And the immortal words of Cuddy, don't care. But awesome that the rumor that Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, he did it on purpose to screw over the Colts, who are the ones who started the deflated football controversy. That's the rumor. If that's true, awesome. I love it when billionaires do petty things. Blackhawks lost again last night to the Flames. Man, come on. They needed to come out of the gate strong after the All-Star game. What did they do? They've done just the opposite. Was it 3 in a row now that they've lost? The window to the playoffs is closing like that wall in Raiders of the Lost Ark. Now the question is whether or not the Hawks can be all Harrison Ford and reach back and grab that hat. Not get shot by the dart, the poison dart, before they get on the plane. Zimmerman doesn't think it's going to happen. I don't know. Maybe I'll try my trumpet. Ba, 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 ba. Northwestern's coming on, though, for the first time this year. They beat a ranked team, right? They got the victory over Michigan last night. They were ranked. They still have to win out. But they're putting together a nice winning streak at the end of the year here. They got Maryland and Michigan State coming up. They can win those games and get to the second round in a Big Ten tournament. There's a chance they could be dancing again in March. If anything, it adds some excitement to the end of the college basketball season. And finally, tonight, scientists discovered previously undiscovered language in Malaysia. A whole new language. Did you see this story? It's crazy. Clicks and tongues and slurps and nonsense words. All of it. When the scientists got around to interpreting the sounds, this is what it was. It was Kylie Jenner named her baby what now? In clicks and tongues. That's the carry out for February 7, 2018. With possible big snow coming this weekend, we're selling lemonade snow cones. So go ahead, eat the yellow snow. It's delicious. Coming up, reporter A.D. Quigg from the Daily Line joins us to talk about the apologies and some non-apologies. Get us up to speed on some of the races happening this year's Illinois primary. And Dan Navarro joins us at 8 o'clock. It's a download, 720 WGN. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio now. A.D. Quigg, she's a reporter for the Daily Line from dailyline.net here in Chicago. Covers everything from the city to Cook County to the state of Illinois. A.D., good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
You guys join us every Wednesday night here when we have shows. It's been a couple weeks. All right, so let's talk. There's a lot going on in Illinois politics. We have finally gotten to a point, which is amazing to me, that we are in the sweet spot. We are in the wheelhouse when it comes to this primary, which started maybe this time last year, but this is when it's supposed to be.
It's been a really, really long primary season.
Right? And this
early
is when
voting starts in 2 weeks.
I guess that's my first question.
Yeah.
Is early voting going to start? I saw the headlines yesterday saying because of ballot challenges,
yes,
they're pushing that back.
Yeah, they push it a little bit. There are a ton of ballot challenges happening right now, which, you know, you can't decide who's on the ballot until most of these challenges are played out. There have been times when they've changed the ballot on the very last day before elections, but military voters overseas already have a ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Early voting starts here on March 21st.
Well, how can they have a ballot if we don't know who's on it?
It's...
All right.
Yeah.
It's a rhetorical story. Question, A.D. Well, okay, so let's talk about... I mean, I am interested because I guess before we get into Pritzker and Ives and everything that's happening, when we talk about early voting, is this a alarming size of ballot challenges? What is making this year different? Does it have to do with David Orr? Like, what does it have to do with the fact that why are we waiting? Why is it pushing the early voting, the beginning of early voting back?
I have been following one race in particular. I think there are a lot more races going to the second round of challenges. So there's a first round, which is with the quantity of your signatures, and then the second round, a lot of people can go to challenges kind of the quality. Are they notarized right? Are they circulated correctly? So there are quite a few going to that round, including a lot of judicial races, which is interesting.
Okay, there you go. So this has become a political tactic, if you will, to to take
tale
on challenges.
As old as time. Challenge,
exactly.
challenge.
But now it actually has an effect on voters as early voting gets pushed back because of all the challenges. All right, Edie, let's start with the news of today. J.B. Pritzker, who's running for governor on the Democratic ticket in the primary coming up here in March, he's obviously, we've seen him for the last couple of weeks and these Blagojevich tape ads that Governor Rauner's been running against him. But it also came out that he said some disparaging things about African-American candidates to replace Obama when he was talking to Blagojevich. He has this essentially calling out their race, talking about race in a somewhat insensitive manner. I wouldn't go as far to say it was racist or anything. When you look at it, he's not using any foul language. But the thing, it made everybody unsettled, especially the African-American community.
Yeah, it was, to a lot of people, it sounded like horse trading, and that they were very bluntly discussing racial politics, which have always been an aspect in Illinois and Chicago politics. But to hear two white guys kind of talk about what black candidate would be good for this position and their personality qualities that would make them good or bad. Describing Jesse White as kind of a safe pick, Emil Jones as crass. A lot of people were kind of uncomfortable with how blunt the language was and who was having the discussions. Two powerful white guys.
Yeah.
It was described as horse trading.
And today, J.B. Pritzker goes in front of to apologize.
Yeah.
And he's flanked on one side with Jesse White. He's got other African-American leaders there. And when you ask Jesse White, he says, oh, I didn't take offense to any of it. But his apology was about being insensitive.
Yeah. He said, I was not at my best in that call. And that's essentially what the African-American politicians who are still backing him said. You know, we all have bad days, and I don't think any of us would like to be wiretapped having a sensitive political discussion, but we still stand by him. We think he's a good guy. We know what's in his heart, and he's done good things for our community.
And
so
we're
going to keep backing
him. And you've been following leaders in the African-American
right.
community today. What did I have to say?
So standing beside him at this apology session, Secretary of State Jesse White, very powerful political figure in Illinois politics. He's been around for decades.
And I just read the Cabrini-Green, a total side, the Cabrini-Green book by Ben Austin, High Risers, which he was on here. Jesse White plays a huge role in being a father figure to a lot of kids in Cabrini-Green in the 70s and 80s. Anyway,
I digress. Jesse White, Tumblr, yeah. He's still doing it. So Jesse White stood by him, Alderman Walter Burnett, Alderman Pat Dowell, Alderman Carrie Austin, Alderman Michelle Harris. Austin, Harris, and Burnett all have very strong ward organizations, so it's important that they stood by him because they can, you know, mobilize people on the street to get out the vote. City Treasurer Kurt Summers, Alderman Rod Sawyer, Alderman Michael Scott Jr. all stood beside him and said, you know, this was disheartening to hear. This wasn't a fun conversation, but we still support JB and think he has the best chance of defeating Rauner.
I mean, you just named pretty much all the African-American leaders. Tony Preckwinkle.
Eight out of the 12 the Aldermanic Black Caucus.
So the others, does anyone coming out against, or are they just being silent?
He has not had any major defections.
Really?
Yes.
I know Rod Sawyer had something to say where he's disheartened, but he didn't pull his... I mean, maybe it's just the media is the one that's really going after it, apologies and trying to get him to, and of course his opponents on the Republican side especially. But
And on the Democratic side are saying this makes him unelectable, but so far no major defections. And
the big one today, which is a head-scratcher, the endorsement of Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, which is not the head-scratcher part. The Republicans quickly after the press release came out today went and said, wait a second. She already endorsed him. She came out in October. Here's video. Here's pictures. Here's the transcripts. You are recycling her endorsement to essentially deal with the controversy with the black vote that you have right now.
Yeah. So Pritzker's campaign has said, you know, we didn't have a formal endorsement. Here it is. And when President Preckwinkle was asked about it today, she usually has a press conference after the Cook County Board. She's a very stone-faced person in press conferences, and she was like, I have supported JB. The formal endorsement came out today. I think we need a Democratic governor, and I think JB...
So she backed it. She said this is the formal endorsement.
Yeah.
I don't expect you to answer this, but I kind of... I am thrown aback by that. I'm thrown aback as the fact that it just seems to be coincidental timing. I mean, I know that she came out before, but now she came out for real. I don't know. I don't know. The cynic in me, AD.
You've been living in Chicago for a while.
All right. So obviously, you know, he was able to damage control J.B. Pritzker on this for the leaders of the African-American community. But is there any thought about the fallout to the actual African-American vote when it comes to the Democratic primary?
It depends on how much people pay attention and how much Pritzker's challengers play this up. As the primary goes along, and let's say JB does win the primary, how much Governor Rauner plays this up during the general?
Mm. Yeah, we're going to see a bunch of commercials around it, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen Governor Rauner make that huge ad buy where he played a huge section of the tape, and, you know, he's got money to throw around, so I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more of that.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Jeannie Ives on the other side. Jeannie Ives, what a tremendous week last week. Started the week in front of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. Essentially, all critics saying that they're all analysts saying that she won a debate with Governor Rauner. ended the week in controversy, not just locally but nationally, about an ad that was deemed insensitive or offensive to trans people, to not just one group, many groups.
Yeah.
She doubled down at the City Club this week saying, I don't think the ad was offensive. I stand by it. What's offensive? And she's made the rounds in media talking about defending, not apologizing, doing the non-apology thing and saying there's nothing wrong with this ad. Is this going to hurt her? I mean, is this something that is expected? I mean, is it good for her that people are talking about her ad, or is it bad?
I think the way she put it at City Club was, I don't see how it's offensive. And truth be told, I have to win, 400,000 plus one voters in this primary season, and I don't have the money Bruce Rauner does. And the message in that ad is what I believe, that Governor Rauner has betrayed conservative voters by backing these initiatives that she said were in this ad and portrayed by people that a lot of people thought was xenophobic, homophobic, racist. But she says, I think I stand behind the message of the ad. And I think she thinks that will appeal to a lot of voters.
And maybe it does in the Republican primary. But to win a general in the state of Illinois, you have to attract a moderate base.
Right.
This is poison to a moderate base. This is not necessarily the kind of harsh messaging you want to put out on television on a full weekend blitz.
Right. And she came out with a follow-up ad that says, now that I've got your attention, here's more about me. So, she's playing up her background and her kind of conservative bona fides.
And what's next for her? I mean, she obviously continues to get more and more money.
Yes. She got a big $2 million influx from Dick Uihlein,
who used to be a Rauner supporter.
Yes.
So what does that mean? Is it more ads? Is that what money at this point means?
Yeah. I mean, the big thing that scared a lot of other Republican challengers off from primarying Bruce Rauner was that he has an incredible amount of money to throw around. And she has a little bit more to play with. I'm not sure how she's going to deploy it. I think TV is very popular, but TV is very expensive. But I think with this money, we're going to see a little bit more TV ads and a lot more attention on this first one.
A.D. Quigg, reporter at the Daily Line, joining us here on Wednesdays. The Daily Line joins us all the time. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk about the assessor's race. That's the one that you've been covering closely, and it's getting heated over there as some information is going to come out, a study that has been done by the Cook County, but will be released by the Cook County Board President, Tony Breckwinkle, coming up in a couple weeks. A.D. Quigg, my guest. Stay with us. It's Download Here, 720 WGN. A.D. Quigg in studio. She is the reporter at the Daily Line, which she joins us every Wednesday to talk Illinois state politics, city politics, county politics. County politics is where we'll land to end the segment tonight.
That's where it's at.
The assessor's race between the incumbent Joe Berrios and two candidates, Fritz Kagi and
Andrea Rayla.
Andrea Rayla is happening here. And it's all under this cloud that the Tribune has done a couple of investigative pieces about how the property tax system under Assessor Berrios is rigged. And in doing so, it has caused a lot of kerfuffle on both sides of the aisle. We've seen it in the State of the State. It got mentioned, and it's mentioned by both parties that are running for governor. Where are we with this story? Because there's going to be a big assessment of the assessor's office coming up here in a couple
assessing
weeks.
Assessing the assessor. So after the Tribune story came out, which was this summer, President Preckwinkle announced that she asked the Civic Consulting Alliance, which is a pro bono group that does, analyses of all kinds of things, was going to study the assessment system and say, here's how you're going to fix it. We have been waiting for that for 7 months. And President Preckwinkle, Tribune wrote a follow-up story saying,
where is it?
They're slow walking this thing.
There was some concern they were trying to slow walk it till after the primary.
Right. President Preckwinkle said, no, it will come out before the primary. It will come out next week.
Mm.
So there's an independent analyst from Virginia who has been doing this big study for months and months, and he's going to come out with
recommendations. Is that bad for Berrios, or it could be good for Berrios?
It could be good because they can say, for the next month before the primary, we're actively working on a solution, and we're going to make the system fair for everybody.
The race, which makes it interesting, is that there's been a lot of turmoil because of the investigation and because of what's happening with mostly downtown properties and taxes, that you would think that the assessor would be in somewhat hot water, but all of the names from Speaker Madigan to Democrat names to Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, to Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, sort of. I mean, hasn't really come out.
Yeah, he said we need to look at it.
Yeah, but they're all. I mean, everyone is backing Joe Berrios. He's the Cook County Democratic chair, right? I mean, he's right. So it feels like they're not going to go against him. It's not unlike what you see in other situations where they recognize that's the candidate that they're all in line with. So they're even if there's controversy around, they're not going to support him.
Right, but you also have this remaining kind of progressive surge left over from Bernie's campaign in 2016, where they're like, we need to get rid of these old school Democrats who have had control of the system for decades and decades. Fritz Kagi and Andrea Rayla have both run on an anti-Berrios platform, but they're both kind of stuck battling each other in the suggestions process.
Do they split the vote in the regard a progressive vote that might be going after a Joe Berrios because there's two of them?
Possibly. I think Andrea Rayla thinks that she will win. She has a good chance because she's a female candidate in the year of a woman. But both have, you know, similar messages about we have a corrupt pay-to-play system and Joe Berrios needs to go. So I'm not sure how much they differentiate from each other after this ballot objection process is done. That kind of remains to be seen. But yeah, they first have to get through this objection process.
Okay, so they're, of course, around that. And we will see next week a study that comes out that's taken a look at, an independent study that's looking at the property tax system here in Chicago. We'll be on it. We'll pay attention to it. Adi Quigg will be back. She's a reporter for the Daily Line. She joins us on Wednesdays. Adi, great to see you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a singer-songwriter who's going to be at Shuba's this Friday night. Chicago, put your hands together. Live in studio for Dan Navarro.
This is the first song anybody ever heard out of me here in Chicago a bunch of years ago. Don't waste your breath. Don't waste my time. If I hear one more excuse, I'll lose my mind. It's been a quiet war behind closed doors. Ain't it getting hard to keep your balance anymore? Walking on a wire, higher and higher. You told the truth, but you're still a liar, walking on a wire. You deal in black and white and everything in between. You were blessed with such finesse, I almost know what you mean. Now I could close my eyes, pretend to let it pass. But you live on borrowed time and it would never last. Walking on a wire, higher and higher. You told the truth, but you're still a liar. Walking on a wire. And how does it feel with the whole world watching? Do you feel like you're gonna fall? Was it safer with your back up against the wall? And why did you try when you knew you were losing? Just one mistake and you're losing it all. Don't waste your breath. Don't waste my time. If I hear one more excuse, I'll lose my mind. Walking on a wire, higher and higher. You told the truth, but you're still a liar. Walking on a wire, walking on a wire, higher and higher. You told the truth, but you're still a liar, walking on a wire. Ooh, oh, 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 oh. You told the truth, but you're still a liar, walking on a wire.
go. Dan Navarro. Dan Navarro, longtime fixture in the LA music scene, writing songs for several artists like Pat Benatar, Jackson Browne, the Bengals, just to name a few. But he's also known as one half of the new folk duo of Loewen and Navarro. Mm-hmm. Tragically, Eric died from ALS back in 2012. Dan's become a solo act for the last 10 years, getting back on stage and after recording a live album, back with a new studio album called Shed My Skin, which is pressing now. It's going to be out in March.
It's pressing now. It'll be just like about a month.
All right. Dan Navarro has such a diverse career. I mentioned the music above, but he also writes for soundtracks, for other artists, commercial jingles, even does voiceover work.
Voiceover work's been crazy lately. I mean, I did a couple of video games. That's gotten way more attention than any of the music stuff ever did. Some guys going,
funny,
yeah, you wrote that big hit for Pat Benatar. Wow, that's pretty cool. Oh my, you were in Fallout 4? Get out of here. Really? Oh my God. This guy.
Dan Navarro is going to be on stage at Shuba's coming up on Friday. Also going to be in Michigan and in Valpo.
Yep, going to be in Michigan, going to be in Valpo on Sunday. I come back here 3, 4, 5 times a year sometimes. You know, it's been a long love affair with this area.
I was going to say, you've had such an illustrious career, to almost 30 years touring.
Almost 30 years touring.
To, Chicago has to play, it has to be a part of your memory.
It's
right?
my favorite place to come, man. I've got friends here. I've had girlfriends here. I mean, this is a place where I've got a real life and real people that I care about. And so I come back very, very regularly.
For this tour to be special, to actually be pressing the new album, and the new album's coming out, playing new stuff, what's it mean to you to have an album waiting in the wings?
You know, it's nice to have something to look forward to and something new to work with and to promote and to put out there for people to accept or absorb. You know, the industry's changed, but I'm in this. I'm on this limb. There's no crawling back to the trunk anymore to get down this tree. So I just keep pushing and having fun, and you know, I still enjoy it. That's the thing that's never changed, even through some of the tougher times, you know, whether it was frustrations with record companies or things not going like we hoped or losing Loewen. You know, they were tough, but this has still been a great ride.
Well, there's so much to talk to you about because, as you mentioned, you have such a diverse career. And I really thought about maybe talking about how you write a song, because having the studio album come out here, this will be your first studio album.
My first true studio album, because the other album was
on stage. Talk about how your music has evolved. To be a solo artist, to be in your 10th year of doing so, how has it evolved from the day that you said, okay, I'm on my own, to where we are today?
No one to bounce stuff off of. When I started making this record, I was determined to write everything myself. So there were no collaborations but one. Of the 8 original songs, 7 were just me. And I hadn't done that in decades. I mean, I was used to bouncing off ideas off of Eric. And when that changed, it was a different experience. And I had to really wonder whether it was going to be fun anymore. And, you know, certainly my career depends on it. But, you know, I mean, if it's not fun, it doesn't matter how much money is there.
Yeah.
And so, no, it's been real heartening and a lot of fun and a real joy to find a way to reinvent and to keep going out there.
If you're so used to doing it one way, and you then go to a solo way without being able to bounce things off and be collaborative, how do you push yourself? What do you have to do to get yourself in the artistic frame of mind?
What I have to do is dig deep. I mean, I have to start thinking about the things that matter to me, thinking about what's on my mind on a given day, what's bothering me, what's making me happy. But what I don't, without having the partner there, what I have to start doing is interviewing myself. Like, so what's this mean to you? Yeah, okay, so that sounds like that's not very good. You know, so what? And ask myself the so what question instead of being asked by my collaborator. You know, I'll write something and hand it over, and the guy goes, you know, this part's good, I don't really care for this part. And rather than arguing it out, you trust and you figure, okay, how can I make this better? You do that with yourself. So it's a lot of schizophrenia.
Dan Navarro in studio. He's going to be at Shuba's coming up here on Friday, and also Michigan and Valpo over the weekend. He's got a new album coming out, Shed My Skin, which will be out in March. Let's take a quick break, because when we come back, I want to talk about the different ways that you do write music in different styles. If you're writing for a soundtrack
places.
Or you're writing, yeah, there's absolutely different ways to do it. Dan Navarro, longtime singer-songwriter, in studio with us tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Dan Navarro in studio tonight, one half of the new folk duo, if you will, Loewen and Navarro. Yeah. Eric Loewen passed away in 2012. Dan is now a solo act, 10 years in the making. He's got a new album, Shed My Skin, which is out in March. And he's also on stage at Shuba's this Friday. Longtime singer-songwriter. He's worked on everything. I mean, to essentially just call you a singer-songwriter is kind of bogus in the way that you've done so many.
It's a piece of what I've done.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I started out not very successful, so I had to diversify. So I got into songwriting. I got into singing in commercials. Started playing in bands. somebody said, hey, you might do a good voiceover once in a while, and I would do one or two voiceovers a year, and they all kind of took off. So it's like, you know, the guy with the plates on the sticks, and several of them worked out. So I have a really fun time doing a varied, interesting, weird life of different stuff every day.
You grew up in California.
I did.
Well, was there a time when you got serious about being a musician in L.A., where you were like, we're going to do this way, and you ended up doing something else? Meaning, you know, you and Eric, we're going to be on stage, we're going to be our own act, and then someone's like, well, you could also write for artists, or jingles.
That's exactly what happened. We were trying to push bands, and they weren't going anywhere. And then Benatar picks up this one song, and it turns into a worldwide smash hit. So all of our friends are saying, well, I think it might be time to give the bands up and just be these hit songwriters. You're making a great living. You're involved in business, and we're going, yeah, no, we want to play music out. So we started playing in clubs, and we got really lucky. When we were when we first came out here to tour in 1990, I mean, it's 28 years ago,
yeah,
we had already been in the business for about 10 years. And people thought we were nuts for deciding to give up, you know, the lucrative writing for other artists and the Bangles and Benatar and submit to Tina Turner and submit to all the people doing the stuff. And it wasn't that much fun. We had a whole lot more fun just telling
what was not fun about it. Because I'm always interested in the life of songwriters, especially for the big artists, because it seems to be more of a 9-to-5 than people recognize it to be.
Very much so. You get up in the morning and you work. You write stuff, you dig deep, and you make something worthwhile. You don't wait for inspiration. You don't wait till your heart's broken and you get excited about something. You get up and you make up a song about something. You look around and you find inspiration anywhere. There's paint peeling off the wall. So you write a song called, you know, I Feel Like Paint Peeling Off the Wall. And somebody slapped me up there someplace and now I'm all peeling. I don't know. I mean, you'd think this is where the ideas come from.
Right.
You just start making stuff up.
A lot of times, and I have some friends who do this work, but a lot of times it is a job.
Absolutely.
And is it hard to delineate between the art that comes from your heart, the art that you want to put out as Dan Navarro,
right,
and the commerce that you're essentially doing, which is art, but it's commerce to be sold to Tina Turner, to the Bangles?
Exactly.
As an artist, how do you wrestle with that, the idea that you have both of these things have to be
initially really awkwardly? They're two sides of the same coin, and you start thinking that you're two different people. You start thinking that you're making up your songs from your heart, but then you have to put on a different hat and fake it to write songs about something you didn't happen to feel that morning at breakfast. As you get more experience, they start integrating better, and you start finding things in your real life that you can draw from for a commercial perspective and create something that just works. You know, you're not doing your own life story.
Mm-hmm.
You get doing fiction. And if you're writing your own life story, you're good for 5 or 6 songs, and then you start repeating yourself.
That's so true.
You know, I mean, I've got friends every once in a while who kind of go, you never really did find that girl, did you? You're kind of like on girl number 20 right now, and you never did find her. Well, it's a subject I like to write about. But, you know, and I mean, poor Joker sitting there trying over and over again. Now, you find a way to integrate, and you find a way to get the stories to come from a real place, even if they're fiction.
Can you innovate in that space? Or
absolutely.
I mean, can you be in a position where you push boundaries, knowing that you need to sell this as a commercial property?
Well, you actually push more boundaries when you're selling less. I found that I took fewer chances when I was pushing for commerciality, because I wanted something that would hit right down the middle,
right,
that wouldn't have what I call elbows, things that stick out in a song that bother you. We had a situation where Bangles cut one of our songs, and I had a line in it that I'd written called We Work It Out Like Business That Won't Work Anymore, about a relationship that's on the rocks. And the producer's going, yeah, that's not a hit word. Well, kind of too bad, because that's the word I meant. And when I wrote the line, both Eric and Susanna Hoff sat there, and their heads were nodding up and down going, oh, we know what that's like when you're on the phone. And, yeah, the kids need braces on their teeth, and Joe's got homework coming, and you know that this is the person you used to talk about how much you miss them.
Yeah.
And here you're talking about business. And it's painful, and it's awkward. And where did that person go? Those stories come out every day, and those are the things that I like to get into.
One of the things about working in the other, whether you're writing songs for commercial, for other artists, soundtracks, things like that, I would assume that you have truly figured out how to write a song. Some of it is math. Some of it is science.
Absolutely.
And all that. But you are
I can make a credible song about almost anything right here, right now. microphone's got a sign, says WGN Plus. Sitting here having a conversation about the three of us. I mean, you just find a place to go and you make it work.
That's a hit.
You can write a song about almost anything.
Yeah, that's the question for you as an artist. And now in this part of your career where you're putting out your studio albums, how much do you take from those experiences of learning really nuts and bolts on how a song works? And how do you apply it to the music you do today?
Every single day. You learn the craft and it helps you. It informs the artistry. The artistry is there to give resonance to the craft. Without the craft, you've got this big ball of goo of emotion and feeling, and no one cares. Without the art, you've got this pretty thing that doesn't move anybody. So you kind of push them together, and you mess around with them. And it's a tug of war inside yourself, and one day the dark side wins, and one day the light side wins. And you just keep pulling and pushing and pulling and pushing until the story comes out. And when the story starts coming out, if you give yourself goosebumps, you've done the job. And that's when you really know, because you can't control goosebumps. We can control anything. We can laugh at things that aren't funny. We can eat food when we're not hungry. We can cry even though we're not moved to tears. But you can't stop a goosebump. That's a visceral, reflexive reaction. And when you're writing something, it's either because you've embarrassed yourself terribly or you've hit the dinger. And they're both the same thing. Embarrassment isn't being misunderstood, man. Embarrassment's being found out.
It's also a very human emotion. Extremely. One that is very relatable.
Yep. And, you know, so you put those things out there. And the more experience you get, the more you take chances on things. And playing it safe doesn't work anymore. You can make a competent tune about a story that kind of works. And, I mean, I've written songs in 10 minutes. I've written songs in 10 years. You know, can't find the second verse, can't find the true story.
I think when you talk about artistry, I mean, it is one of those things that I find to be miraculous for songwriters. It's really hard for me to do it. I don't know it. I'm not in it. But when you learn the structure of a song, especially a pop song or what, you know, might be written for pop artists, yeah, it's like a light bulb goes off.
It's all, but we're all trading in the same thing. I mean, you do it here. I suspect that as you're talking to me, you're not just listening to me. You're thinking two questions down the road for what I might touch on that might lead to your next question, but you don't want to go too far afield. And these are all part of your craft. The art is making it look easy and being spontaneous. And it does look easy. It's how I'm a blast sitting here talking with you, and you're thinking of things that people don't think of. That's the pro in you.
Dan Navarro, the longtime singer-songwriter, has got a new album coming out called Shed My Skin, which is going to be out in March. He is at Shuba's Friday night, and he will also be in Michigan and Valparaiso, Indiana, coming up this weekend. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. A little bit more live music. Sound good? Dan Navarro, stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in the studio, longtime singer-songwriter Dan Navarro. Lowen and Navarro, of course, for many years. Eric Lowen tragically died of ALS back in 2012. Dan is a solo act now. He's been doing it for 10 years. He's been on the road for 30 years of his life.
He's been on the road for 30 years, man.
He's got a new album, Shed My Skin, which is out in March, and he is at Shuba's this Friday night, and then also in Michigan, Valpo, coming up in the weekend. You know, one of the areas I want to talk to as well is about collaboration, because you mentioned a little bit earlier about collaboration.
Yep.
When you start working with writers for voiceover work or writers for soundtracks or producers, mm-hmm. there's collaboration means a lot of different things. It used to be you and Eric collaborating on how to write a song.
Right.
But I would assume that that word means a lot of different things for you in this industry.
It means different things in different disciplines. Collaboration for me as a songwriter was making sure that I got what I needed to say said, but that we wound up with a finished song. Collaboration as an actor has meant listening to the director to give him or her what they want so that we can accomplish what we need to accomplish. This is where, you know, if I'm writing a song and Eric said, that line doesn't do that, I might go, well, yeah, it does, man. To the director, I don't do that. And the director, he says, that line doesn't do that. I go, wow, man, I thought it did. Okay, now what do I got to do? How do I put something on it to make it different? And it's always a challenge to deliver.
Just knowing some stories and just about how the music industry works, a lot of times, and this happens frequently, a song that's a very popular song will have several writers, right. either rewrites yes. or maybe oh, yeah. you just have the hook, or especially maybe you now. Just got the two or three lines, but there are 15 people working on a Justin Bieber song that's or whatever right. it might be. Have you experienced that where you just play one little part of the song for the soundtrack?
Or? I've done five-way co-writes, and they're quite awkward, usually one or two people.
What does that mean, leading. Five-way co-writes?
Eric and I had a hit with a group called The Triplets. They were three sisters that were triplets, and we wrote this song with them that went top 15. And Eric wrote most of the chord progression. One of the girls wrote most of the lyric to the verses. I'd come up with the lyrics to the chorus and the idea to the chorus. And the other two women didn't do much. But that happens. I mean, it's somebody ends up sitting back and letting someone else lead. That collaborative process can be very mano a mano. It can also be split up into very distinct yeah. roles. And it changes every time.
Is that something that you see from afar, now that, you know, obviously on the road and with your own music, but when you see the industry and the way that they write music today, is it different than what you and Eric were doing?
Without question.
10, 15, 20 years ago?
There's a lot more formula. There's a lot more melodic pattern that gets, you know, repeated over and over again. There's a way to create a song these days, and that's what the committee type work on the 5, 6, 7 writers, is that they'll each contribute that little bit to create this structure that works. What I'm kind of missing is, where's the artistic point of view? Where's the story that's going to drive me to tears or make me excited? You know?
Dan, I always wonder, I don't know if it's a cynic in me, but when I listen to a top 40 song or something that is very personal,
yep.
talking about love or breakups or their pain or anything, they're really out there. And the cynic in me goes to, someone else wrote that song.
Right, right.
right away, I go right to it. Like, that's not their song they're specifically speaking about in their first person. Am I right? Am I usually right in that case?
It's really true, but there's an aspect when a singer takes on a song is that they've got to be able to own it. You know, you can sing the notes, and there might be pleasant notes and good words, and you can make it work. And in the old days, I mean, the singers all did the same material. Sinatra and Tony Bennett and Jerry Vale and Steve Lawrence and Vic Damone all did the same material, and they all put their own little spin on it. That's changed in the writer era. But basically, ideally, your writer really meant it when they wrote it, and the singer, when they heard it, said, I have to do that because I feel that. Now, there's nothing wrong with them saying, I have to do that because that's just a big old smash hit, and
right.
I'm going to have a big
right.
old smash hit with it.
Right.
You know, so it's,
right.
I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with it.
Commerce works. You know, there
commerce
was a
works.
Joke many, many years ago about Billy Ray Cyrus with his song Achy Breaky Heart. It was called Lucky Effie Break. And yet he parlayed that Lucky Effie Break into
yeah.
something lasting, not just for him, but for his daughter. And, you know, there's a lot of people can be put down for whatever they might create, but try being up there.
Dan Navarro, longtime singer-songwriter, a collaborator, and also part of the duo Loan and Navarro. Eric died 6 years ago.
6 years ago, man.
I mean, I even hesitate to even bring it up because you guys had such a tremendous career together and a partnership and a duo. You truly were a duo. That was the name of the band.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you feel about it 6 years after the fact? And here you are on the road in familiar places and the radio studio starting to go, going to be on Shuba's stage and all these things, but not
you
with
know,
Eric.
It's been different. I had to get over missing him on stage. First of all, we had a long run period. We were over 30 years of friendship and partnership, working on music together a long time. We had a long career together, but he also started changing early and lasted a long time after he got diagnosed. He was 8 years with the disease. So the singer that I grew up with changed. The guitar player that I grew up with disappeared. My pal didn't leave till he died. And I miss my pal every single day. But musically, I kind of had to get over it.
Yeah.
You know, I still do the songs. I talk about him. It's a real part of my life and my career, and that's what people remember. And I don't have a problem with that. You know, it's not like, gee, all they want to hear about is Eric. Thank God they want to still hear about Eric, you know? It's I always used to, you know, think about, like, Simon and Garfunkel or even Paul and John, you know, McCartney and Lennon, going, yeah, I don't want to talk about the other guy. Okay, sure, how's that working for you? I mean, you know, millions upon millions of people hung on every word.
Yeah.
And I did. You know, we were lucky that we got to do that for a long time, and he was one of the best friends. He was the best friend I ever had. But it changed, and I had to learn to get over missing him on stage. I had to learn to get over stage patter and singing alone and touring alone. The first time I'm out on that road by myself in a car going, no one to bounce anything off, no one to crack jokes with. I'm going, do I even want to do this? Yeah, but I did. I did.
Well, Dan Navarro will be on stage at Shubas on Friday. He's also doing some shows this weekend in Northwest Indiana and Michigan, Michigan and Valpo. You can find all his stuff at his website, dannavarro.com. Dan, the new album, Shed My Skin, is coming out here in March. Before I let you go, you got one more song in you?
I got one more song.
What are we going to hear?
This is probably my favorite song on the record. This is called Bulletproof Heart. It recounts events that actually took place right in front of Space in Evanston. I had a dream. I flew like a bird to the top of the mountain, and there you were, bathed in the shadows, alone in the dark, with a lock and chain around your bulletproof heart. Minute by minute, time after time, body to body, crossing over the line, wrapped in each other, a shower of sparks began to melt the ice away from your bulletproof heart. Somebody tell me, please, are we really here? I opened my eyes, then you disappear. And all the king's horses and all the king's men can't put the genie back in the bottle again. Now I try to remember, to try to forget the way I felt that night, but it ain't happened yet. One perfect kiss blew the shackles apart that keep you locked inside your bulletproof heart. Won't somebody please tell me, please, what's happening here? The image is hazy, but the memory's so clear. And all the king's horses and all the king's men can't put the genie back in the bottle again. So where are the fault lines? How deep are the ties? And can I ever touch the fire I see in your eyes? We can come together, or we'll come apart. But I cannot come away from your bulletproof heart. Your bulletproof heart. Too hard to imagine, and too late to pretend that all the things we said and did won't happen again. So how do we finish? Where do we start to break down the walls around your bulletproof heart? Your bulletproof heart.
That's great. Dan Navarro in the studio tonight. Oh, this is so great. Their album is Shed My Skin. It's out next month. He's going to be at Shubas coming up on Friday night. And, of course, Michigan and Valpo over the weekend. Dan, great to meet you.
You too, brother.
Thanks for coming in.
Anytime, man.
It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Nice to have Dan Navarro here. 630 said, first dance at our wedding, Lowen and Navarro. Spell your under. There you go. It's great. Yeah, and, you know, we didn't really get into it because I didn't want to be like, tell me about that Pat Benatar song. As he does We Belong. That's one of the best songs of all time. Also, the song that's used at the end of Talladega Nights.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just saw Talladega Nights this weekend. It was on. And I was like, oh.
That's a good one.
We belong. I think it's the last one where they're racing after they did. I don't want to spoil the movie if you haven't seen it since 2012 or whenever it was. But they get out of the cars and they race on foot. And then they make out. Right, right, yeah. I forgot how it ended, but great. We Belong was the song. Yeah.
Well, Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly, a formidable duo. Yeah. They should just get together all the time.
I think the world's about ready for another Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly.
Yeah,
joint,
another,
right?
Step Brothers 2.
Yeah, right.
Shake and bake.
I don't even know what that means. It feels good. You know who doesn't get enough credit for that movie is Sacha Baron Cohen. He plays the French driver in Talladega Nights, Rick and Bobby, and he's so good. He's such a good actor. And Andy Richter, who's just on The Download this summer, plays Sacha Baron Cohen's husband in that, as the French husband, and they go into the bar. Say you love crepes.
And he's a world-class German Shepherd trainer.
Exactly. Good stuff. Yeah, you're absolutely right. John C. Reilly. And up to that point, I mean, John C. Reilly was in Boogie Nights, and I guess that's a comedy, right? But he had a career of doing dramatic work.
Yeah, I was in a lot of those, you know, Paul Thomas. It was Paul Thomas Anderson.
Thomas Anderson.
Yeah, because he was in, you know, Boogie Nights, and then... a few other ones.
But yeah, and I think he had an Oscar nom too somewhere in there too, John C. Reilly. I forgot for what movie, but he was in one of the movies where he got an Oscar nom that was a serious role, so he almost was painted as a serious actor. And along comes Will Ferrell, and the two of them get together, and he has unleashed what is the comedy gold that is John C. Reilly. And if you ever get a chance to see, probably the funniest thing he ever does is Stephen Brule on Adult Swim, where he is a... What is it? I forgot the name of the show, but it's something with Steve Brule, Brule. It is outstanding. Little snippets. They're 5-minute episodes, 8-minute episodes, and he's doing like almost like a cable access TV show, and it's just John C. Reilly. It's so good. It's so good! All right, coming up tonight, we're only halfway through the show tonight. It's hard to believe, but we still have... Listen to this lineup. So Charlie Newell will be in, the artistic director at the Court Theater. The Court Theater in Hyde Park, one of the greatest theater companies, not just in Chicago, but in the world. They really take on classic playwrights. And we had Charlie in when he was doing the Tom Stoppard play last summer. Well, he's back because he's taken on one of his passion projects. This is a project that he's wanted to do for his entire life. It is the play All My Sons, and the playwright is Arthur Miller. It is the play in 1947 that was done 1 year before Death of a Salesman.
Wow.
So it was, I think at that point, I could be wrong on this, but he was not an established playwright. He was maybe this, All My Sons, maybe his second produced play, Arthur Miller. And it was the third play was Death of the Salesman, and his career took off, The Crucible, not long after. And it's so amazing. Not a lot of people are going to look at plays that are not the standard Arthur Miller plays. All My Sons. So Charlie Newell, this is a passion project. So he goes ahead and he says, okay, I'm going to put this on stage. Finally, I've been working on this for 10 years to get this ready. And who should play the matriarch? Who should play the mom in this play? I know. How about my wife, Kate Collins? His wife, Kate Collins, a famous actress. I mean, she was on All My Children. And she had the good fortune of playing her character and then also the psycho twin sister on All My Children. Which is great. I mean, if you're going to get into soaps, you have to be able to play the psycho twin sister role as well. But Kate Collins, they moved to Chicago, her and Charlie Newell, and they raised a family, and Kate got out of acting. And so Charlie had to persuade his wife to jump back up on stage after taking almost 18 years off. And Kate Collins is getting great reviews, 4-star review from the Chicago Tribune for All My Sons, which is at the Court. So we'll talk with both of them coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. And up next, Mike Reed. Mike Reed, longtime jazz drummer, composer. I would say, he says arts presenter, but he's the founding director of Pitchfork Music Festival. He's also on the programming board for the Chicago Jazz Festival. He's part of AACM. He's the owner of Constellation and Hungry Brain, both in Roscoe Village clubs. He's done so many things. He's really at the epicenter of creative Chicago. Mike Reed, my guest, he's going to be with his project Flesh and Bone, which is amazing. It's going to be at Chicago Symphony Center at the Orchestra Hall here on Michigan Avenue coming up on Friday. So, Mike Reed coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then the last segment tonight, we say goodbye to Sammy Panionovich, the Chicago WGN legend. No, legend's not the right word. If it's not legend, then what would you call it? Rob, what would you call Sam Panionovich? Legend? You'd call him troublemaker?
I would call him
weekend anchor.
What's that phrase that people are using? A thought provoker.
Thought provoker. Yeah, there you go. Thought provoker, Sam Panionovich.
A change agent. He's a change agent.
Change agent, Sam Panionovich.
When I see that on people's LinkedIn pages, I go, "Oh, what? How about if I smack you?
How about I follow? I'm gonna follow you. You're a change agent. I'm gonna follow you. I'm gonna invite myself to your LinkedIn page.
What Sam is a solid sports broadcaster, and I couldn't be more proud of him.
And he is also leaving the station, and he is going to Las Vegas. He starts his new job this weekend, but he is going to be with us tonight because he's been a huge contributor to this program over the years. So that's all coming up with the halfway point. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download 720 WGN. I am Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the show, Charlie Newell and Kate Collins talk about their play at the Court Theater. It's called All My Sons. It's an Arthur Miller play from 1947. Actually predates Death of a Salesman. It's on stage. It's been extended through February 18th. We'll talk with Charlie, who's the artistic director, and his wife, who is the star of the show, Kate Collins. Kate Collins, well known to many for her star turn in the 80s, 90s, and All My Children. Not only did she, and I have the character's name, it's in the prep. I'm not a soap guy, but she played that character, the famous character, Kate, I think it was Kate something, and she had to play the psychotic twin sister as well. How great is that, right? That's like every actor's dream. There's great clips on YouTube of her having to do split screens of like the demanding character and then the psychotic sister. It's tremendous. And all the great hairstyles, too. There's a lot of great hairstyles going on. Also, Sam Panionovich talks about leaving the station. Sam, of course, our longtime sports reporter and anchor, is leaving to take a job in Las Vegas. It's his last time on the air, I believe. Will be tonight at 10:30, so we'll talk with him. My next guest is bringing his Flesh and Bone project to Symphony Center on Michigan Avenue this Friday night. Jazz drummer, bandleader, and composer Mike Reed created Flesh and Bone after a harrowing experience getting trapped in a neo-Nazi rally in Eastern Europe while on tour in 2009. He took that experience as inspiration for the music and the album that was put out last spring. Here's a track. Track from Flesh and Bone. Again, Mike Reed and his fellow musicians will be on stage with Flesh and Bone at Symphony Center coming up on Friday. Reed, a cultural leader here in Chicago. He's not just a jazz musician, but he's a producer and founding director of the Pitchfork Music Festival. He's also on the programming board for the Chicago Jazz Festival. He works with the AACM. He owns a couple clubs here, Constellation and Hungry Brain, both in the Bricktown neighborhood. Here's what Chicago Tribune music critic Howard Reich said about Reed. A multi-threat musician who thrives as soloist, bandleader, presenter, and global talent scout, Reed has emerged as a center of gravity for music in Chicago and beyond. Mike Reed with me tonight. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get right to the flesh and bone neo-Nazi story. I mean, this is one that it's tremendous. When I went back and actually found the blog,
yeah,
you know, and read the actual story of what you and your bandmates had to go through on a foreign train station in the way of just waiting for a connecting train. But this music is inspired by a harrowing experience that happened to you.
Yeah, so in 2009, we were on a quartet tour with this band of mine called People, Places, and Things. And going from Hungary, we were basically trying to get to Krakow, Poland. And in the midst of it, there was a bunch of different train connections we had to make, and one being in particular in the Czech Republic. And it basically what happened was the train conductor told us to get off in the town that was actually not the town we were supposed to get off on the ticket. And the town that he told us to get off on, it turned out that that day was the day that they were staging this very large, you know, nationalistic skinhead rally. And, you know, it being at, us being at the train station, it wasn't a very big town. But, of course, people were coming in from all across, you know, the area to participate. And so, you know, the group, you know, two African-Americans in this group, you know, we definitely caught some attention. And the rallies seem to find its, you know, its apex at the train station.
Which is amazing. You say in the blog, too, that you would think that the apex would be at the town square or what, not that you guys would be safe at a train station.
Right. So, you know, when we first showed up in the town or in the at the train station, it was relatively quiet. And we walked out in front of it and we just started to see, like, you know, sort of the police caution tape. And then we noticed there was some, you know, overly outfitted, you know, sort of SWAT team police walking around. And we just assumed that maybe there was like a 5K run happening, or maybe there was like some little, like,
right,
you know,
some event
commemorative parade going on that day. And, you know, we started to walk to maybe find something to eat because we had some time between what we thought was our train. And we got stopped by, you know, an officer and said, "This isn't safe for you here. There is a skinhead rally here today." So we just tried to hang, you know, went back to the station and tried to find some place to sort of, quote unquote, hide. Really just sort of, you
stay
know,
out
keep,
of sight.
Yeah, stay out of sight. And that was not really possible at all. And so, you know, I mean, we also didn't quite understand that, you know, we would ask at the counter, it's like, "When is this train coming, going to Poland?" And they would say, "Oh, it's in 3 hours." So we had all this time to kill. And, you know, more and more people are showing up. And all of a sudden we realize we could peek out the window in front of the station. And there's hundreds and hundreds of skinheads out there. And then a line of just armored, you know, vehicles. And, of course, SWAT team police and dogs. And we're just, of course, losing our brains, you know, just kind of not knowing what to do. And
well, Mike, you say in the blog post too that as a black man you're used to some sort of racial strife. You understand that there's going to be awkwardness and things, but you've never been confronted with an actual rally where the whole point of it is staring you right in the face.
Right. Right. No, I'm like you know, prime dinner at this moment, you know, or at least it felt like that. So, you know, I'm not sure what the how they or why it sort of really found its apex at this train station. I'm not going to say that it, like, they, you know, I'm not going to say that they completely caught wind of this and say, "Hey, let's stop it here," that we were there. But maybe to some extent, or yeah, so for whatever reason, that's where the things really hit. And, you know, at a certain point, we just started to hear, like, these loud explosions. And a mob is coming through the train station, and, you know, the riot was on, and it was basically, you know, the SWAT team firing tear gas, You know, attack dogs coming through, and we couldn't run towards them because obviously they're firing all this you know, sort of anti rallying, you know, whatever stuff at these skinheads. But then the skinheads sort of developed their own like line of defense, and you know, had they were ready. They knew this was going to happen. They had their own Molotov cocktails. They had their own gas masks. You know, and we're just kind of like getting pushed around.
Jazz musicians. I mean, you had your instruments with you.
Yeah, I had my cymbals on my back, and of course a little suitcase, and we're just trying to run. And there's really no place for us to run to, so we kind of get into the tracks and start running down the tracks to try and get as far as possible. And maybe we get about 100 yards out, and there's just a battle going on. And there's a guy who just sees us, and he's sort of standing there in like a ski jacket. And he's like, oh, you better come with me. It's not safe for you here. And we're like looking at him.
Yeah, like,
thinking,
who are you? Right.
Should we trust this guy? But, you know, I'm like, well, if he wanted to kill us, he'd do it right now. He wouldn't like usher us outside. So it turns out that this guy was actually sort of an off-duty officer. And he was like, he wasn't working that day, but he kind of came to sort of check in. And so he helped sort of hide us in this little building that was just outside of the train station. And, you know, in his broken English, he was like, oh, where are you going? And trying to figure it out. And they hid us in there. And you know, he would come and check every once in a while. And then trying to figure out where we were going and what time, you know, we were going to be able to go.
The story continues. And, you know, you have some confrontations on the train when you get on the train. But as a musician, and to have that experience happen, and for the way it played out, and to narrowly escape, and there's much more to the story, and you can go read it on the blog, but to narrowly escape, how does it turn from something that obviously has a human impact, an emotional response, to music? I mean, how does it go from being scared out for your life to on stage at the Symphony Center?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that you're a creative person, you're making, if you're a writer, if you're writing novels, if you're making films, if you're a visual artist, so what are you really using, you know, your life experience, the way that you look at life, right. And if I'm not using this experience, a very moment where it's like life is actually the question, if I'm not using that somehow, if it's not being expressed in the things that I make, I'm not really sure what type of creative artist I am. So, you know, I mean, that was the takeaway, you know, a few days afterwards, I sort of swore to myself that at some point I'm going to have to figure out how to deal with this as a maker. And that's one level of it. There's the other level of like, how am I dealing with this as a human being?
Right, right.
And that's kind of like what happened finally with the record. It took a number of years. I didn't know what to do with it. And I thought that, you know, in a certain sector of the musician world, the story had gotten around, has become a little bit of like a little folklore. And that's cool. Or, well, it's not cool, but it is what it is. But, you know, trying to make something of it, especially with what I do is mostly instrumental music, how do you replicate or try to tell a story with that or an idea with that? And I just didn't know what to do for a number of years until it kind of dawned on me that the story in itself is sensational, or at least at the time it was, and unfortunately these days it seems to be less and less sensational. But it's a sensational story. Obviously, this isn't happening to most people ever. But you know, stories like this, I kind of thought about. It's like, well, they're like the types of stories like a myth stories or fables or, you know, the type of stories that your parents tell you. They warn you about or tell you something about what life is or how to look at life. You know, isn't that like Sisyphus pushing something up? Or that whole...
Yeah, the morals and fables.
Yeah, and maybe in a certain way, this story is kind of makes you look at what your regular life is and how you think about yourself as, you know, otherness in actuality. So like, for instance, like my physical body being a, you know, in jeopardy, being a threat, being, you know, like what people want to you know, appropriate it for, you know, also like what my positioning and with other people, you know, whether it's, you know, being very, you know, I being conscious of like people that work for me, younger people, and like their, you know, their attitudes and ideas. And so that was, you know, how do we think about ourselves?
Yeah.
You know, one funny thing, when I was the bass player in the band, who Jason Rebke, and at the time, he, you know, he, this is the funniest and also most awful thing, he's a guy who has a full head of hair, but for a number of years shaved his head, and which is just kind of blasphemous, I think, for most for most people out there. Right. But and at the time, he had a shaved head and kind of wore very sort of dark clothing, and he could have been construed as maybe a skinhead.
Wow.
And so we were talking about this, you know, now years later, and he was like, "Yeah, you know, I was folding the laundry, and I have these orange pants." And I was, and it realized to him, it was like, yeah, I bought these more colorful clothing after that whole Nazi incident because I just felt like I didn't want to be associated.
You don't want to be association, you know? And like you said, otherness, and also being singled out. There's so many threads and things that you could pull from to make art, to make music. Mike Reed in studio, drummer, band leader, composer, his project Flesh and Bone, which is based on what he just talked about and the experience from touring Eastern Europe in 2009, will be on stage at the Chicago Symphony Center and Michigan Avenue on Friday night. We'll take a quick break, Mike, and we'll come back and we'll continue the conversation. Stay with us. It's a Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Mike Reed, jazz musician, producer, composer, drummer. I mean, and also a presenter in the sense that he's the founding director of the Pitchfork Music Festival program. He's on the programming board for the Chicago Jazz Festival. Is there anything you don't do, Mike? You own clubs in town. I mean, there's so many things that you do to put yourself front and center when it comes to the cultural landscape. You are a part of your Flesh and Bone project, which is going to be on stage at the Symphony Center. It's also an album. It's all sorts of things. It's writings. It's interviews. But the music part will be on stage at Chicago Symphony Orchestra this Friday night at the Symphony Center right on Michigan Avenue. Mike, we were just talking about that experience of being caught in the middle of a skinhead rally in the Czech Republic and how that inspired the project that's getting on stage at the Symphony Center. When you talk about all those, I mean, it really is about central themes, right? Themes push music. Themes mm-hmm. push your creative output. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily that you're creating notes and frames and like, this is when the tear gas went off and it goes like this. It's like, it's not like a soundtrack or you're trying to recreate it. It's really using your musical talent to explore the themes that you felt from this experience.
Yeah, I mean, the event. But obviously there's... the reason that rally was happening has its own ideas and ideological whatever themes, you know. So getting, I think, maybe at the heart of what's happening with people and then, like, what's that mean to you? So, you know, obviously this was a nationalistic rally. I mean, xenophobia, I think, was at the heart of it. It was mostly, as we found out later, designed as a protest against the Roma population in the Czech Republic. But, you know, obviously, the xenophobia in general is their underlying sort of idea. And so, you know, the notion of otherness in a grand, you know, this sort of grander word, you know, that's, I think, encapsulates things, obviously, like racism, but we're also talking about, like, whether it's, you know, gender, whether we're talking about, obviously, nationality. We're talking about so many different places that can go to. So I wanted to, one, be able to bind that notion with everybody's humanity so that they can find their own otherness in it, and also try and, you know, see that in other people, but also see, you know, that the commonness.
The whole experience... As it feels, and when you read it, and when you hear you talk about it, it does seem like something that is from another world. But it also, when you hear you talk about it, and a person is talking about it, and the way that you approach being in the center of something so violent and traumatic, it resonates. Not unlike the music, but it's this concept that it's relatable because you automatically, you're a fish out of water in that situation, right? I mean, you are the person, a fish out of water who also has a lot of fear because of the color of your skin, mm-hmm. because of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I feel that connection in the way that I may not ever be accidentally in the middle of a sure. skinhead rally in Czech Republic, but I can understand where that feeling comes from.
Right. And I mean that the feeling and the ideas around it is, you know, this is something that I don't think we have to sort of be put into like a situation like that for us to be able to look at it. I mean, shouldn't we be looking at it and considering these ideas? Isn't that maybe part of the reason that we have, you know, so much visible separation amongst, ourselves these days, especially in the U.S. And, you know, we're seeing this in other countries as well. Because we're not really like taking that chance to really examine each other in that way. We kind of hold up sort of barriers.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's some of those things. But there's also this tie into like, yeah, our own sort of common bond of mortality, you know. So as much as we want to have all these separations, it's like in the end, you know, there's obviously these... the more unifying aspect of being alive.
For you to write music about this experience before this, and you've had a ton of music, I mean, People, Places, and Things, and the other stuff that you've worked on, and even with Pitchfork and all the other places, and maybe you've taken on big ticket items or big feelings and thoughts in your music, but is this the first time that you've made this project like this based on a personal experience that really wants to get to the heart of something that you see affecting the entire world?
Yeah. I mean, the thing there's universality in the themes, but it's definitely like personal, and it's also kind of, you know, on a certain level, you know, of course, there's a lot of the issues that I'm dealing with is race related, and it's also identity related, meaning. There's a piece that's inspired by Duke Ellington, Piano Introduction. And, you know, there's a lot to be said about basically, like most people might say, he's like the most important figure in jazz, one of the most important figures. But, you know, there's so many things that is very misthought about him, that he's not really a great long-form composer. Even though he's thought of being maybe the greatest jazz composer, he also is like really not really adept at writing music and has lots of copyists that are doing that work for him. So there's some of these sort of contradictions about who he is and how we sort of paint these pictures of him. Another piece that on it entitled I Want to Be Small, it's dedicated to the Chicago painter Archibald Motley. And, you know, he's mostly considered to be part of the Harlem Renaissance, even though he's not from Harlem, and he's from Chicago, and I believe he grew up in Lawndale, I believe it was. But at the time, which was mostly not a black neighborhood, and married to a German woman, but most of his work really depicts African-American nightlife in Bronzeville. And especially also a lot of portrait work where he really gets into the deep ideas of skin tone, the different ideas of African-American skin tones and you know, persona. And but like his sort of personal life might sort of really challenge this notion that you might have of him on the surface.
Right.
So there's this sort of otherness that's happening with him. A lot of his paintings that you might look at, he's almost looking in on these scenes instead of being part of these scenes.
Yeah, it's interesting, the theme of otherness. Mike Reed, jazz drummer, band leader, composer. He is taking his project Flesh and Bone, and it will be on stage at the Symphony Center on Michigan Avenue on Friday night, this Friday night. He'll be there with other musicians as well. We'll talk a little bit more about his work here in Chicago as being a cultural leader and the collaborations he's done beyond just jazz music, of course, being one of the founding directors of the Pitchfork Music Festival. Mike Reed, my guest tonight. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Mike Reed, Mike Reed, longtime jazz drummer, band leader, composer, music presenter, producer. I mean, he's done so many things for Chicago. Flesh and Bone, his project that we were just talking about in the earlier in the 9 o'clock hour, will be at Symphony Center at Michigan Avenue this Friday night. I've thrown your credits around. The Pitchfork Music Festival is a founding director. He's still heavily involved in the booking of this festival. If you're a listener not familiar with the Pitchfork Music Festival, that's hard to believe, only because it is one of the go-to music festivals in the country now. I mean, in the world. Right here in Chicago in Union Park, it's grown since 2005. You know, you're in the midst of putting it together. I mean, is this crunch time right now as you get ready to unveil what a lineup might be for a festival like this?
Yeah, this is definitely a important moment. We're going to, you know, the lineup will come out there fairly soon, within the next month. We'll put out the lineup. You know, I from the booking standpoint and some of the initial planning stuff, you know, the festival usually happens the third week of July, and then pretty much the second week of August, I start booking the next festival. I get a few weeks off, and then we just go into it. And it literally, it takes about 7 months to really get it together. And most of the stuff is kind of laid, you know, like just conversations with, you know, the Park District and with, you know, obviously the bigger important pieces. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're working on all that sort of background stuff, obviously evaluating what happened the year before and trying to set the game, so to speak.
That's such a... the Pitchfork Music Festival is one of the festivals that's on the edge, meaning you have to have your finger on the pulse of what's happening in music to get the band at the right time that's coming up. Pitchfork usually is where they might get launched. See, a lot of people after they're in Pitchfork are on a fast track to be at Lollapalooza or other places, or even having meteoric success. How difficult is that for you as a creative in Chicago to have the right team in place to think about who's getting booked and where you're going to book them and being creative about who you put on stage?
Well, you know, that's funny. That it really was, and I think it still is, from my standpoint, about being creative as a promoter or presenter or whatever you want to call it, producer. I think initially some of the things that inspired me was, you know, like there was All Tomorrow's Party, a very, you know, mm-hmm. well-known curated event where they'd get different artists to curate and their favorite, you know, weekend of bands. There's another event, Arthur Fest, by this little zine. I don't know, it was more than a zine, but a publication, Arthur Magazine, and they would have a similar sort of thing. The Village Voice used to have this thing called Sirens Fest. And so these were all these really well sort of crafted and thought about lineups. And, you know, now, like, the festival industry, you know, when we came in, it wasn't quite a festival industry. There was, I think, Coachella had been around for maybe 3 years. Bonnaroo had been around, some small regional things. And, you know, Lollapalooza and the traveling festivals, like Lilith Fair had died in the traveling festival incarnation, and it didn't have, you know, what we were trying to do is create basically a boutique event, something that we would want to go to. We didn't want there to be, you know, 100 bands, because you can't see 100 bands in 3 days. We wanted there to be a small amount that you can manage to see as much as possible, and really, you know, dig into curating it. I you know, that word now has become way too overused, but really select, like, as if you're doing like the best sort of DJ set or best, you know, mixtape of a weekend of artists. And it's funny now, these years later, that the festival industry has grown, that we can see some of these lineups, these big festivals, and they all look exactly the same.
They do, man.
And so, you know, we've always been super conscious about trying to be unique, sometimes to a fault, and really try to get to that, back to that ideal, and that we want to create something that's a special moment. And for people who, you know, it's... music has become like a lifestyle accoutrement, not like an actual, you know, thing that you do and invest your time and energy and interest in, you know. So we like still putting that as the forefront of why these people get together.
I just wonder how much of that is the industry, meaning the festival industry, where bands know, and you see this a lot with big festivals like Lollapalooza, where you know, you can almost guess by who's got a record and who's going out on a summer circuit, who's going to be at Lollapalooza. Eminem is going to do this to be able to put a tour together. How much you have to fight against those forces of the industry kind of aligning like that to say, okay, well, this is how we're going to market this. We're going to put this album out, and then we're going to do this. How does that affect you trying to put on a creative, unique festival?
Well, yeah, you know, there's two parts to that. One, as the, you know, the, over the last almost 15 years now, the festival that has, you know, circuit that has become an industry, also then started to really become part of a certain type of industry, like Live Nation and AEG, these two mega, you know, the two largest promoting companies in the world, you know, buying up all these festivals that started up as independent events. And now, so it makes sense that you'll have, you know, let's say Eminem, like, playing all these different festivals. You think they're different festivals, but they're actually all owned by the same companies.
Yeah, it's, because it's almost like a tour. I mean, you put together a tour. You're just going to hit this festival on the East Coast, this festival on the West Coast. It's all the same stuff.
So that can be challenging, but I think really where it works out for us is that the artists still want things to be unique. And they still really covet those certain festivals that do have a spirit that doesn't, you know, is his own thing. So, you know, we have this festival, and it's been in the Great Union Park. It's a wonderful, one of our wonderful parks in Chicago. But I will say, and this is not a slight to it, it is a just it's a city park.
It's a park.
But one of the events that we always, you know, always get compared to is a, or at least in the spirit of it, is this festival in Barcelona, Primavera, which takes place on the water. You know, it's like this beautiful, amazing layout. And I never understood that, but I think it has more to do with the spirit and the uniqueness that's happened there, and not necessarily the sort of the landscape. So that feels great to me to know that we're up there with one of the most, you know, sought after events for artists to play.
It is. You're right. The spirit and the uniqueness of a festival. Do you worry about Pitchfork getting too big? Do you worry about, I mean, it's now been 13 years, but do you worry about outgrowing a place like Union Park?
Well, I think that part of it, going back to the original idea, we don't want to make it too big, because that kind of goes against the sort of initial principles that it came up under, and also then would just kind of fall in line with these other events.
Right.
So there's that. Now, it would be wonderful to be able to grow, not necessarily for numbers' sake, but for size sake, so that we could do things that made the event more enjoyable for the attendees.
More porta potties.
Yeah, well, you know, air conditioned, you know, toilets would be great, you know.
Right.
And if we had more space to do that, you know, we probably could add that. Or also just put like slightly more space in between the stages, just so that, you know, those issues of there's certain place where there's a bleed, you know, it'd be nice to just have a little bit more, or just a little bit
That's
more production.
Uniqueness, though. That's the spirit of Pitchfork,
right? It is, but, you know, so I would love to have the option. And then if the option came down to, no, let's leave it like this, that, you know, so I think the growth would be to try to make the amenities of it and the uniqueness and just better for the audience. You know, there's a Christian saying that goes, I am third. And I'm not really a church person, but I remember I had a roommate and he had this little thing that his aunt gave to him. And I asked him what it was, and he's like, oh, yeah, for Christians, they say that God is first, others are second, and I'm third, right? So for the staff, for Pitchfork, for the festival, I always say this to them. It's like, look, the artists are first, the attendees are second, and we are third in this whole, you know, equation. And actually, I say that I, Mike Reed, are third, and the rest of their wishes are way down on the list. So I need to be happy for them, but all these other aspects, you know, the attendees and the artists have to be happy before I am. And I think that's that sort of notion, like, really it kind of moves around the park, you know, from the staff to the artists, of course, and then the attendees feel it. So I think that's a lot of what's happening there, you know, because there isn't a lot that we can say that is hugely unique except our efforts.
Right. I just, you know, I wonder about Pitchfork's role in the ecosystem, because you have your hand in the jazz festival. You've mm-hmm. talked about a lot of the downtown sound stuff, the stuff that's curated down here at Millennium Park, and of course Pitchfork and a lot of and owning clubs. When you talk about the whole ecosystem of what Chicago means to music, or and not just in this city, but in the country, is Chicago growing in that capacity? Is Chicago a closer to being an epicenter than it is to being an afterthought when it comes to music and how we deal with music festivals and bands and everything that goes into that industry?
Well, you know, I think right now, there seems to be an idea, you know, not an idea, this is a thing. Different, you know, scenes, they come up and have their moments. You know, obviously, there was a moment with Athens, Georgia, you know, Seattle, you know, for some years now, everybody was moving to Brooklyn and, you know, a hot indie band out of Brooklyn. Chicago's had its different moments, too, for various different musics. More recently, I would say probably like the 90s and early 2000s with, you know, bands like Tortoise and the whole sort of post-rock sort of thing, Jim O'Rourke and that whole moment, and even a little bit certainly in that time period too with bands like Smashing Pumpkins, more of the mainstream sort of thing, or Veruca Salt, that type of thing. Right now, of course, we're having like an amazing time period, you know. I mean, of course, you know, you can't go anywhere without hearing about Chance. And, you know, then folks like No Name or bands like Whitney, you know, Twin Peaks, Ohm, like all these really great acts happening right now. And that's just like in sort of like the more hip hop and R&B and rock thing. But then like for the jazz stuff, there, you know, like Mekhi McRaven, who's, you know, all over the place, you know, Marquise Hill, who's moved to New York, but he's always keeps that. Oh, I just saw him in Paris, you know, he's representing Chicago, you know, so there's like a huge tidal wave of Chicago stuff happening right now. What I hope is two things, you know. Well, one thing that's happening is a lot of those folks are staying here. You know, like all those, you know, those bands, like I mentioned, like Whitney and, you know, Chance, and of course, that whole scene of people, they're all staying here, and that's great, you know, keeping that energy and recognizing that, you know, you can be incredibly successful here in Chicago, you don't need to go to the coast, so that's a great thing. I hope that, two things, that it, you know, the music community is going to do what the music community is going to do. It doesn't necessarily need as much, I think, help as people want to say or try to, you know. I know there's always sort of thoughts or rallying, you know, maybe even politically, to sort of like, we need to infuse the music. Or it's like, we wouldn't be here with all these amazing musicians if they weren't able to do this.
Yeah, they did
and
it on figure their own,
out.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Figure out. And I think we need to be supportive of that, but not necessarily have to try and tell, as I like to say, you know, we don't have to tell the heathens about religion. They're going to figure it out for themselves, right. You know. We just need to support it in a lot of ways. And by that, I'm hoping that, like, you know, with people staying around, supporting artists, that we can also do something larger for our long-term sort of history. And what I mean is, like, looking back at itself. So, you know, when we think about, you know, Mavis Staples, and then we have somebody like Jeff Tweedy working on Mavis Staples records, you know, or, you know, thinking about like somebody who, you know, I've been more recently in contact with, but Gene Chandler, the Duke of Earl, you know, and, you know, Constellation, I named after Constellation Records, which was one of the labels that he was associated with. And, you know, he has a Duke of Earl wine that's coming out, and he wants to, like, you know, do a wine tasting with us. So, you know, trying to figure out, like, these relationships to our own history and keeping that going and keeping that moving and not losing sight of that. So by keeping people here, but hopefully also by supporting them, I think that's really the thing that I'm hoping for most.
Pleasure to have you here, man. It's great to have you on the show. Mike Reed is bringing his Flesh and Bone project to Symphony Center on Michigan Avenue this Friday night. Check it out. Mike, of course, also the founding director and present-day booker of the Pitchfork Music Festival. He's on the programming board for Chicago Jazz Festival. He owns Constellation and Hungry Brain, both in the Bricktown neighborhood. He's got a lot of things going on, and you're always welcome back.
Oh, thanks.
Mike, great to have you here, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN, Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Rob, you going to Pitchfork this year?
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah, you're gonna be there?
I'd like to go.
Who would you want to see?
Oh, man.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I would like to... That's what I want to figure out. Esmeralda, who would you want to see? If you Rob, and I are going to go to Pitchfork.
Pete
is going to go, but then he's going to quickly leave us and go, you know, do his thing somewhere else, and with his cool, fancy sweater on, his hipster sweater. And then we'll be like, what happened to Pete? Oh, we can't get cell phone service. He never came back. That's what's going to happen. That's what the hip, cool people do, Rob.
In the summer?
Yeah.
They wear sweaters?
Oh, yeah. He'll definitely be in a sweater. Trust me.
80 degrees.
You know, I'm the dork who goes to see, you know, any of the artists and thinks that I know things about. I've got the one song. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is great. Love it.
Hearing Mike talk about Pitchfork, I wonder if this year, if that means that they're going to try to be as unique as possible, right?
I like that about Pitchfork. At least I'm like an old lady and I never know who's there.
Right.
And I go just kind of like, I'll listen to whatever, and I just wander around listening to stuff. And I've picked up really great things. Like, I didn't know who Run the Jewels was when they played.
Nice.
I was just like, who are these people? I like them.
You and I were there.
Yeah.
I actually showed up right at the end of the Run the Jewels just to see Chance, because Chance was on right after him or those guys on the other stage. And it was really, really tight, right? Everyone was shoulder to shoulder. And these teenagers like sneaking past you. Excuse me, get in front. Get in front. Can I get in front? And it was a friend of ours' daughter who was like 16, something like that, right? And she was with all her friends. And my wife was like, oh, Jenny. And I'm like, shut it. You think they want to see us in our polo shirts?
Come stand next to us.
Hey,
no.
Hey, I remember when you were 5. Like, you know, like she looked up. And she looked up at my wife, and she like did the thing that was like, "Oh, I think I know it." Like, it's just a great moment where I was like, hey, "Why?" And my wife looked at me like, "I know, I was stupid. I shouldn't have said anything." It's like,
see, if I was that teenager, I would just kept walking.
Yeah, she
keep pushing,
much did.
Keep pushing through.
She'd get a smile like, "I don't know you. Please don't say another thing to me." And I'm like, "Oh, we love Chance. We love Chance." Oh, my God. It was ridiculous. So that could be us, Rob.
Oh, yeah.
We'll just try to find the people's friends of ours, kids.
I've heard people in the know say that they do enjoy Pitchfork more than Lala.
Yeah, it's good.
So, good on them.
It's a better spot for your hipster sweater in June or July.
Well, you guys will be the ones in the back with the lawn chairs and
right.
The blanket.
Right.
And you don't move the entire
yep.
day.
Yep. We start and we think we got a good spot, and then we get mad because it's not a good spot, and now all these teenagers are trampling our blanket.
And they're standing around you.
Got the Chardonnay.
Excuse me, we got here at 10 a.m. No, you cannot puke here. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. What was announced that the play All My Sons at the Court Theater has been extended. The famed 1947 play written by Arthur Miller is actually one of the first plays ever produced for the legendary American playwright, who's most known for his plays Death of a Salesman and The Crucible. Where else will you find great plays from the greatest playwrights than the Court Theater in Hyde Park? The theater's dedicated itself to the works of famous scribes. The artistic director Charlie Newell is directing All My Sons. It's got a 4-star review from Chris Jones in the Tribune, and it stars the great Chicago actors, including Kate Collins. Collins is well known to Chicago theater audiences, but also known nationwide for her Broadway and soap opera performances, including playing Natalie Marlowe and her psychotic sister Janet on All My Children. Offstage, Newell and Collins are an item. Well, in 25 years of marriage, I guess that does constitute an item, right?
Definitely an item.
The show All My Sons is on stage at the Court Theater through February 18th. It's my pleasure to have Charlie Newell and Kate Collins in studio tonight. Good to see you.
Thank you, Justin. Great
Thanks
to be here.
Thanks for having us here.
Yeah. Let's talk about this play. I remember when you were in before, Charlie, we talked about that this was coming up this season, so it's awesome to have you back in studio to talk about it.
Yeah.
This play predates Death of a Salesman, predates The Crucible.
Yeah.
What makes this play special in the canon of Arthur Miller's work?
Well, I mean, it's so extraordinary. He wrote it at age 27, and it has clearly stood the test of time, and clearly you could see sort of foreshadowed in it issues that he was going to raise in some of his more well-known plays. What was exciting is we were able to use earlier drafts of the text and incorporate them into our production
really?
In a way that we saw it to fulfill where we thought he was going to want to take the text in the next iteration.
Is that a normal thing for directors to be able to do that? And when you're talking about playwrights, maybe newer playwrights, and right. you don't necessarily get access to the earlier drafts, but because Arthur Miller's so famous, everybody knows all of his work.
Yeah, well, that was what was so fun. We found out that University of Texas Austin, they had the initial part of the Miller archives. You may have read recently in New York Times and about fights that are going on about some of his later archives, but luckily we got access to this and found some really helpful information about his aspiration. He wanted to create a tragedy of the American common man and look to Greek tragedy for some models of how that might be done. So again, we just tried to follow these initial impulses of who was known at the time as Artie Miller. Prior to this play, he wrote 200 radio dramas.
Oh, interesting.
Sitting yeah. here in your radio studio yeah. with you, in which, of course, the only way he was telling story was through sound and
wow.
the voice.
So, I didn't know that. That's yeah. great.
So we basically tried to also think about the text as if here's a writer who knows best about the kind of musicality of the text. And so we've sort of followed the text as if almost like it was an orchestral score, if that makes sense.
This is a post-World War II drama, tragedy. But really, and Chris Jones, that was a great review that he gave you guys. You know, when he talks about it, he was talking about this is kind of the end of the American patriarchy as we know it. Kate, what drew you to this role? What was it about playing Kate in the play that you wanted to be involved in this?
Charlie asked me. So we started there.
It's a good place to start.
I know. You know, it's been a long time since I was on stage, and I always said that when our boys got older, I would go back, and suddenly they got a lot older. So I was thrilled to begin with, and then when I read it, I was really intrigued with, I perceive her as a woman who's held a family together, but via secrets. And so what is the cost of that?
Yeah.
What is the cost to the family in the positive and the negative? How do you just love a family through a tragedy that's occurring day by day by day? These little itty-bitty private tragedies that occur in all families
yeah.
everywhere sometimes.
Yeah.
So I was just really intrigued by the challenge of, you know, could you open her heart and what would I learn? So that's what I loved about her.
It is, as Chris points out, it's the men who cause the problems in this play, and it's the women who have to clean it up.
Mm-hmm.
And with everything that is happening in the world today, there's a lot of parallels to it. But when you think about that storyline, you're right. A lot of times that was done in secret. That was almost seemed to be the role of the matriarch or women in the household to be like, I need to keep this together as men fail miserably.
Indeed.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was keeping the facade, keeping it looking good, but, you know, that's just a lot of us live that way, or a lot of us were raised that way, or we all know variations on that theme. So I was really intrigued to sort of dive deep into someone who kind of took that to the nth. I was also really intrigued that Arthur Miller wrote this during World War II, even though it wasn't produced until just after World War II. And some of his text is just so spot on. It is scary.
Wow.
Very scary. Like having your moral star and finding it. And what do you do if it goes out? And how do you live then? Are you a person who can live with lies or not?
Yeah.
And just things that we take for granted and I don't think about day to day. So I was really intrigued.
And there's a way, it's great to hear, especially when you talk about a play that's now, 60 plus years old.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because that's what theater does for us, right? This idea of pushing our conscious, pushing the themes in our lives or making us think about who we are
yeah.
and what we see on stage.
Yeah. It's astonishing to me that at 27 years old, this guy could put this play down on the page, clearly drawing a lot from his own personal life, And that every night at Court Theater, as the secrets that Kate is talking about slowly, inexorably, inevitably get revealed, the audience just gets more and more and more invested, so that by the time we get to the end of the piece, there's audible crying, audible responses going on in the most kind of primal way. And I was like, how did he do that at age 27? Is just masterful.
Chris also said this is your sweet spot. A play like this is your sweet spot. Do you agree with him? When you get your hands on All My Sons and Arthur Miller play from when he was 27 years old, do you, Charlie Newell, you're like, yes, this is what I've been looking for.
Well, I really appreciated he said that. You know, whatever the play is that I'm working on is my sweet spot. So right now, absolutely.
Charlie Newell and Kate Collins in studio tonight. Charlie directed All My Sons at the Court Theater in Hyde Park, and Kate stars in the show. All right, we'll take a quick break. The show is running at the Court in Hyde Park through February 18th. And more with Kate and Charlie here on The Download when we return. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, Charlie Newell, the artistic director at the Court Theater in Hyde Park, which is right now has All My Sons on stage. It was extended. It got a great four-star review from the Chicago Tribune. It's on stage at the Court through February 18th. It's, of course, an Arthur Miller play starring Kate Collins. Kate Collins, a longtime theater and television star who hasn't been on stage in a while. Of course, Charlie and Kate married offstage. Not on stage, but off stage. What's it like? What's it like for you to make the decision to get back on stage? Is it scary for you as an actress to get back on stage?
Yes, that would be a definite yes. It's been 18 years since
wow.
I worked on stage.
I so did not know that. That's crazy.
Oh no, yeah, that was a little nutty. I was very, very scared. But sometimes the things that scare you most are what you need to do the most. You know, you got to kind of take the leap. Now I have to say, God's truth on this. Tim Kaine was already associated with the project.
Yeah.
John Judd was associated with the project. And when you know you might get to go work with that kind of talent, you say yes and thank you. And then Heidi Kettenring came in, and the rest of our company, Dan Waller, Abby Pierce, they're just, it's a magnificent company. And if it weren't so good, we wouldn't be doing so well on stage together.
To think about 18 years, it's a lifetime. It's actually literally
a lifetime.
But
literally,
the
two children worth.
Right. Throughout that 18 years, did you always dream, and I don't mean dream sort of in the, oh, I'm dreaming of being on stage, but did you always sort of imagine yourself getting back on stage and what that would look like?
I did, and then life sort of takes over and you get busy doing other things. So I have not actively pursued it, which is why this was such a gift. Now, in full disclosure, Charlie and I, we've been married 25 years, but we go back to seventh grade. So we met doing a school play in Washington, D.C. We did many all the way through high school. So working together is kind of almost second nature,
right,
if you will. It's just sort of what we do. It's like fun, easy.
Do you have to change your relationship at all when you're in that professional role, when you have to direct an actor, when you have to take direction? Do you have to change the way you speak to each other or communicate with each other because of your longstanding relationship?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have a couple of rules. I mean, there's the one rule is you don't want the company to feel uncomfortable because you're going, honey, can you get the milk too, please? So you don't want to bring any of that home stuff in. That's just not fair to anybody. So we don't use pet names. We don't talk about the show outside of the rehearsal hall. So rehearsal's rehearsal, life is life. And that seems to work pretty well.
We received what I thought was the absolute good housekeeping stamp of approval when I heard in the women's dressing room, where only the truth is spoken, they said to you.
Yeah, they said that they wouldn't necessarily know we were married.
All right, there you go.
So I thought, good, done.
Good, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Obviously, Charlie, when you wanted Kate to come back and do this role, what was it about it? Assuming, I mean, obviously, as the artistic director at the Court, there are several plays a year, many opportunities to bring Kate back in many different roles. What was it about this play, All My Sons, that said, all right, it's time to get her off the show?
Well, I've known since I started my career I wanted to do this play, both because I have, like many of us men, a complicated relationship with my father, and as a father myself, a wonderfully complicated relationship with my two boys. So I knew I wanted to do it. It was a question about when. So 2 years ago, I started reading it and rereading and rereading. Every time I read it, I'd go, you know, Kate would be perfect for this role. Who could I possibly get that would be as good as Kate? And then I went, wait a minute, just ask her. So thankfully, she said yes. It took a little while, but she did say yes.
Kate, it's surprising to me that it's been 18 years. I mean that because your credits are substantial. You had a tremendous career, and to think in a blink of an eye it's been that many years, it doesn't seem that way. And even, I mean, as I mentioned at the beginning, you having soap opera performances, All My Children, and playing Natalie and the psychotic sister. Just today, going in and doing research for this, watching a bunch of YouTube clips of you on Regis, you know, or stuff. I mean, just being part of that New York thing, yeah. that is. Do you miss that? Do you think about those days? Because you had a different hairstyle, you had a different look.
I had a very different hairstyle, that's for sure. You know, I was really fortunate because I went to New York young out of school, and I said I wanted to be an actor, and I got to do that. And then I wanted to have a good marriage and a family, and I've gotten to do that. So I'm really the lucky one. I miss All My Children. And I miss All My Children because it was such a great show to work on. I love the work. Again, I love process, so that was really cool. But no, you know, I had kids, and I decided that it was too hard generally for us to be out nights and weekends. Yeah. I really commend these young people who are doing this in the arts, and there are a lot of them doing this. It isn't easy, and I bailed on it and had the good fortune.
But you're
to be
absolutely
able to stay
right
home.
Because the lifestyle of an actor, especially in New York City, is mostly nights and weekends. There's not too many 9-to-5s that are available. I mean, or mm-hmm. that are even coveted. So yeah. It's very difficult. You're absolutely right to be in a family in which I have a lot of friends who do that, who are artists, and they are right. trying to juggle and figure it out. And it is very frustrating.
Right, and they've got their day jobs. Some of them, even if you're in the union and you're still working nights and weekends, and to have family. It's a lot. It's a lot. So I really commend these young people who are doing this.
Now that the kids are older, yeah. they're adults, do you see yourself now being in a position where you're going to go back to doing more work, doing more theater, maybe outside of the court, getting yourself back in the game?
You know, I might. I might. I sort of have been solely focused on, could I remember all these words? That was my big terror. I might get up there and realize I don't have a memory anymore. Now that I've leapt that hurdle, I think I might explore some possibilities. I don't read reviews, so I don't know what's being said out there, except for it must have been good because they're extending, so I'm rah-rah. And I will probably converse with, you know, Johanna Mackenzie Miller, who's also in our show, and Bradford Lunn, and find out, and Carl Hamilton, and find out who's doing what and what's really going on now in the scene, and see if there's a place for me in it.
Charlie, for you to be in a position where you get a chance to do this play, All My Sons, mm-hmm. and like you said, it's been years of wanting to do it, and it's yeah. and February 18th is coming up fast,
yeah,
and it'll be the end of this, and maybe there'll be remounts or maybe not, but what's it mean to have accomplished that, to have executed something that that has been something of a passion project for years?
Well, it's been, I don't know, one of the most extraordinary blessings in my artistic life, and to get to do that with my life partner, my wife. And how through this process, we've gotten closer and learned more about each other through it and have done it, I thought, pretty well.
Pretty well.
I mean,
pretty well.
Her performance has been extraordinary to watch night to night, as is the entire company. I just feel like the most lucky man in the world, and we get to do it until February 18th, and I don't want to think a day past that.
It is on stage to February 18th at the Court Theater in Hyde Park. The show is All My Sons. It's the famed Arthur Miller play before Death of a Salesman. It's the one right before Death of
exactly.
a Salesman, right before
exactly.
The Crucible. Charlie Newell, and it's starring Kate Collins and others, and like I said, it's on stage till February 18th. And this is perfect for February and Valentine's Day. This is we should have booked this for
thank you.
For the 14th. Charlie, Kate, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it is the final appearance on WGN Radio as an employee. You're not even an employee anymore, so I'm going to need that key card back.
Can I swear?
You cannot swear.
It's after 10.
It is after 10, but we are on Scout's Honor.
Ah.
Sam Panionovich, if you have not heard, is leaving WGN Radio to take a gig in Las Vegas. We'll get into what that gig is, but this is Sam's last appearance scheduled. It could change. Scheduled. With an asterisk next to it. Sam, good to see you, buddy.
Good to see you.
You've been a tremendous contributor to the show. You were nice to me when I started. You were here, and you have always come through with sports breaks and everything that's happening, whether it's live in the United Center or on when we needed to talk to somebody about what was happening in sports and landscape. We're going to miss you, buddy. We really are.
I'll miss you guys. Trivia, real quick.
Okay.
First time I called this show. Do you remember what it was for?
No.
April 2015. You started when?
April 2015, yeah.
Okay, I think your second week was when the Cubs were calling up Chris Bryant.
Right, that's right.
And I called the studio and I said, hey, Let's do it. Who's this? This is Pete. I said, hey, Pete, this is Sam. I cover sports. Oh, hey. And I said, I got some news for you. Chris Bryant's getting called up. And he said, okay, what? Who are you? And I said, I'm Sam. I've been here longer than you. Put me on the damn phone. And you guys put me on the air, and they called Brian up. I think it was April 20th or April. Or actually, it might have been May. It was right around your first month or so.
Absolutely, because Pete and I went to that game. We did the show that night, and then the next day we went to the game.
And you said, wow, look at this full-fledged sports department.
The first thing I said is, I'm like, who was that guy again? Who was that?
Sam who?
Samuel?
Papalopoulos?
We're going to miss you. So what are you doing? You're going to Vegas. Talk about your new venture.
So I'll be working for VSiN, Vegas Stats Information Network. It's on XM Radio. They also have plans for television down the road. Brent Musburger is the lead talent.
Yeah. I just saw him doing a hit on ESPN about it.
They're growing.
Yeah.
They're like a flower that just got planted, and they're continuing to bloom. So they've got big plans. I can't share them all here, but that's why I'm deciding to leave here, everything I've ever known, moving to Vegas. It's sports for Vegas people, and when I say that, I mean trends, lines, odds, you know, line science. Why is this line here? What does this line movement mean? Information, education.
And you'll be hosting.
I'll have my own show. But also entertainment. I mean, that's what we all do, right? We try and entertain the masses. And it's got its own channel, and they've got a lot of good things in the kitty. And I'm taking a leap of faith. You know, I've been here. August 2012 was my first day as an intern, and I feel like I've accomplished all I could here. And it's time to try something new.
You sound so sports-like. You're a sports cliche.
We take it one day at a time.
We take it one day at a time. We try.
You know, all that matters is at the end of the day, you know, day in, day out, we give our best, 110%. Damn it.
You're a Chicago kid. You grew up in Chicago. Have you only lived here? I mean, we'll talk about your life and what you expect, how to change living in Sin City.
I've never lived outside Illinois. So 28 years I've been here. Most of the time in Chicagoland, I did 2 years at U of I in Champaign. Got tired of the cows, tipping cows, got old real fast. So I came back, went to Columbia. I know you know Columbia pretty well. Yeah. And from Columbia, internships, finally the last one here. And like I said, I've been here ever since. But I've been on the south side of the grid, the right side of the grid, by the way, since I was born.
Right.
Hurricane the White Sox, by the way.
Well, that's not confirmed yet.
Oh.
We don't need to go to the air with that yet. But they could be possible.
What are they going to do, fire me?
Yeah, right.
For saying that?
Could be an announcement in the next couple days. Hmm. 708 says, just Jeff in Homewood says, good luck in Vegas. We'll miss hearing you on WGN Radio.
Thanks, Jeff. So people that's the best part. You know, I did my last shows this weekend with Lou and John on Saturday and Rick and Dean on Sunday, and I spent probably 2-3 hours just responding to texts. I don't know if you respond to a lot of texts here. I was responding for probably 2-3 hours because I think that's why we do it, right? We do it for people listening. We don't do it for ourselves. We don't do it for our family. We do it for the chance to, you know, talk to you listening right now. And I really appreciate, there's been a lot of love on social media, on our text line, and people even called in. I did Brian Noonan's show on Sunday, and I really appreciate all your comments, really.
From a sports standpoint, going to Vegas and having to cover that angle of sports and also obviously the national landscape of all sports, not just Chicago, are you going to miss having that experience and being so close to the hometown teams?
I'll miss it, but at the same time, let me put it this way. I think I'll be able to go back to being a fan because when you cover the Blackhawks, Bulls, Cubs, Sox, and Bears, you have to do it objectively. You have to critique when you have to critique and coddle when you have to coddle, and I've been going around and around and around, like with the Bears, like they suck right now, you know, and you have to talk about how much they suck. Now they're on the right side, they're going up. Same thing with the Bulls and the White Sox, they're rebuilding. Cubs, since I've been here, the Cubs, when I started here, the Cubs were at the bottom. Now they're at the top. And the White Sox, and like I said, Bulls are all rebuilding and all that. But I think I'm looking forward to being able to pull away from that and just root for the teams that I love. I'm a diehard White Sox fan. And I tried to mask that here as best I could. but I'm on an island here. I know you're a Sox guy,
I
too.
Am, yeah.
But, I mean, good Lord, this is Cubs kingdom here.
It is.
It's Cubs kingdom. Everybody here bleeds blue. If you cut them, you stab them, they're blue.
And
I'm black.
Yeah,
I bleed black.
You bleed black.
Yeah.
Sam Fanionovic, 630 says, love you, Sam. Going to miss you. Be careful out in Vegas.
Look, anything I can do in Vegas, I've been doing here. Let's be clear about that. Let's be very clear.
All right, this is what I want to do. Let's take a break, and then we come back. Let's do our final.
I brought you a present, by the way. Will you take a sip out of that? Come on, please. There's a little shot of champagne.
Yeah, sure. Here we go.
Please do it. Oh, he didn't even do it. My buddy Raleigh's here. We went to Harry Carey's, and it was my last dinner in Chicago. I'm leaving Saturday, so he's in the house. He's enamored by the studio here. And like you told him,
it's better in the summer.
Better in the summer. So, yeah, I'm in for whatever.
All right, so here's what we'll do. We'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll do our last sort of sports update. I want to get your thought, your parting shot at the teams and where they're at, where they stand. We've always talked basketball. Obviously, we haven't had a chance to talk about the Bulls and what they're doing and accruing first-round picks like they did with the trade with Nico and other storylines as well. Sam Panionovic, his last appearance on WGN Radio here on The Download, so stay with us. Thank you, Rob. Sam Panionovic in studio. He's leaving our station to go west to Las Vegas. So 847 says, have enjoyed Sam's contributions on WGN. Best of luck in Vegas. Keep your Midwestern sensibility, though.
I keep hearing that. Don't forget where you're from. Trust me, I won't at all. That's not a concern for me. But thank you. I really do appreciate all the comments because I have grown up at this station. I started here at 23 as an intern, and now at 28, I'm ready to rock.
You're ready. Now you're an adult. You're full on.
I wouldn't go that far.
I was going to say, wait till you're 35, and you're going to be like, oh, man.
You're 35? You look good for 35.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you. Actually, someone was talking to me just recently, and they said, oh, yeah, we're working on this 40 under 40. You'd be I'm like, I'm 43, but thank you.
No, just say you're 39.
I should, always 39.
So my dad, when he turned 50, he started doing his 29th anniversary of his 21st birthday. Instead
good.
Of saying you're 50,
move.
You just... So when you're 60, it's your 39th anniversary.
You have a very tight-knit fam. How are they taking the news that you're leaving town?
Well, my mom actually said this. She goes, I can't believe you're leaving. I said, Mom, you're in Florida 10 months out of the year. My parents worked hard their whole lives. They're retired. They live in Florida. They still have a house here in Chicagoland. So they're trying to sell it and all that. But I'm like, you can't.
Yeah.
How are you going to? What? You live in Florida 9 months out of the year. No, but they're supportive. They've always been supportive. My brother, too. Have you met my brother, Adam?
Yeah, one point he came through here.
I think you did. Yeah, so he's trying to hang around in baseball right now. So, but they've been supportive from day one. Ever since I left U of I, they've been my biggest fans.
That's great. We always have you on to talk about sports. Of course, we haven't talked about the Chicago Bulls. Let's get right into it. The Bulls trade Nikola Mirotic. They might get a top 10 pick out of this. I watched a little bit of the New Orleans Pelicans stats on ESPN, whoever they were playing, and I saw Mirotic get blown. I forgot who it was. Maybe it was the Rockets. Somebody, they just destroyed him defensively.
Oh, he's a turnstile.
And it just looked exactly like when watching a Bulls game, but he had a white and yellow jersey on. A good trade for the Bulls?
Oh, definitely. First round pick for that guy? 100%. Now, it's top five protected. So
it can't be too bad.
But the Pelicans right now, I mean, I'm looking at the standings. Mavericks are the worst, then the Hawks, Magic, Kings, Suns, Grizzlies, Nets, Bulls, Lakers. So there's room here. They used to be the Hornets, not the Pelicans. Pelicans are middle of the pack. So I don't see them sinking down to the bottom five, which means as long as they're not a bottom five team, the Bulls get that first-round pick. So the Bulls will have, in a perfect world, two first-round picks to add to Markkanen, Levine, Dunn, Valentine, Portis. That's a good thing. And they have a bunch of cap room, too. Like, they can spend, if they want, ideally, they could spend $40 to $50 million this coming off season, which I don't think they will, but they're in a really good spot.
Well, there was a lot of talk about this year's free agent class. Do the Bulls have what it takes to pull the trigger, and do players want to come to Chicago and play with a young core like this?
We'll see. I think they should wait another year, let these two draft picks come in, let them develop, and then you make your move the following year. They're in a great spot. In fact, Brian Windhorst on ESPN NBA coverage, he said yesterday that he thinks the Bulls are in the best position going forward of any team in the league.
Really?
Because you have controllable young talent on the rookie contracts. Zach LaVine, marketing, like we said, Chris Dunn, and then you've got the money to spend, plus two picks in the first round next year, you're in a good spot. And you know I don't compliment that front office ever.
Well, let's talk about that front office, and because you're going out of town, maybe you can be more honest about it, but they haven't had a good track record when it comes to drafting.
Well, Paxson has rebuilt this thing up twice. He did it in the early 2000s with Luol Deng and Ben Gordon, and he got them competitive. And then, of course, they got lucky in 08. They got the number one pick. They took Derrick Rose. So, and that team before Rose got hurt, who knows? I mean, that's the ultimate what if. If right. Rose doesn't get hurt,
they could have had a title or two.
So you never know. So you can't really fault him there. I'm glad they rebuilt. I mean, let me ask you this: would you do that trade backwards? Would you trade Dunn, Markkanen, and Levine for Jimmy right now? I wouldn't do it.
No.
No. So I think that's a great trade.
And the Timberwolves, who are coming to town, they come here Friday.
But you got three guys who can play for one.
Right.
That's a big deal. And going forward, Jimmy Butler, he's not going to get any better.
Right.
He's going to start declining soon.
Markkanen has become a huge surprise to the league. I saw a couple of stories where they said if we redrafted the 2017 class, Markkanen would not be available for the Bulls at seven.
No,
maybe in the top three.
No.
It's amazing. I mean, so you can already say that last year's crop has paid off. The year before, I'm not so sure. The year before then, I'm not so sure. But this year, Markkanen has been a pleasant surprise.
He's been really good. He set that NBA record for, I think, the quickest seven-footer to 100 threes, quickest rookie to 100 threes. I mean, the comparisons keep flowing. Dirk Nowitzki is the comparison. Now, he's got a long way to go because Dirk is a top 10, top 15 player of all time. But Markkanen's on the right track, and that's a great pick. I cannot fault anything the Bulls have done since June 1st. I can't find a problem
with
anything.
Well, you weren't a big fan of them last year when they
because I told you when you started here in 15, I said, look, this team is not good enough to beat LeBron. I said it in 15, they got to blow this up. And they waited until 17. That's fine. They finally did it. They're on the right path now because LeBron in 2 years will be 35. And Father Time is undefeated.
Yeah.
It is. Look at Kobe.
Save that stuff for your show in Vegas, man. You don't be wasting those gold nuggets here on a Thursday or Wednesday night in Chicago.
You want me to stay? I'll stay if you want.
Rerun that
Can
stuff.
Can you give me some cash up front? I'll stay.
With all those golden nuggets. All right. Any way they trade Robin Lopez, Jerian Grant, and get a first round?
They'd love to. Oh, God, they'd love to. First round pick, I doubt it.
How could you? I mean, who would be that interested?
You'd have to sweeten the deal. If you want to trade Lopez, you'd have to probably include a second-round pick or a future first-round pick. You're not going to get a first-round pick straight up for Robin Lopez. Not going to happen.
Yeah.
They'd love to shop Grant, Holiday, Lopez in a perfect world. Yeah, of course, yeah. First-round picks for everybody, but it's not realistic. I don't think they're going to make any more deals. They also, don't forget this, it's good to have a guy like Robin Lopez around a young team. Robin Lopez, I've covered Robin Lopez for a couple of years now. He's one of the best dudes to deal with. He is so positive. He's fun.
Messes with the mascots.
He pours popcorn on Benny. He's a great guy. And I think having somebody like that in this young locker room, it goes under the radar because people don't realize what older, strong-minded players do for a young team. I would hold on to him as long as I could because he's great in that room.
All right, just NBA storylines. The Cavs are awful with Isaiah Thomas. Their defense is crumbling. They've lost almost everything since the Christmas.
And yet they're still in third place, and they'll go to the Eastern Conference Final.
You think so?
Yeah, of course. Who are you picking against them?
Well, I mean, I just watching the highlights every night. Everyone seems to be interested in the Raptors, possibly Kyrie Irving and the Celtics. I mean, it seems like there's a youth movement, and the Cavs are on the wrong side with Dwayne Wade, LeBron James, Derrick Rose, and with that haircut. And they don't seem,
what
they
do
don't
we call
seem to be
what do we call that haircut? What is that?
I don't know.
It's not quite the weekend. I don't know what that haircut's called.
It's like one
called.
Of the kids from Crisscross. Like it's got, it kind of looks it's, like the
if you
other.
Google
Crisscross.
The weekend right now, and you see that hair. It's,
not it's that.
Similar to the weekend. All right, so let me put it this way: in Vegas, where I'm going, the odds right now in the Eastern Conference, the Cavaliers are minus money. They're minus 140 to win the East, which means if you bet on the Cavs, you lay 140 to win 100. They're the favorite. Then the Celtics are 3-1. Raptors are 6-1. Wizards are 16-1. Then we get to the 76ers, 30-1. Okay, we're not going there. So of those four teams, Cavs, Celtics, Raptors, Wizards, You want to take the field? I'll take the Cavs. I'll give you those other three teams. I'll take Cleveland. Because in a seven-game series, we've seen this, JK. We've seen this over the last 7 years. In a seven-game series, LeBron James eventually is going to suck the life out of your best player.
Yeah.
He's done it to Rose. He's done it to multiple other players, Paul George in Indiana. He sucks the life out of your best player over a seven-game series. I'm not saying they're going to win the whole thing, but this Eastern Conference is not strong at all.
Are you going to miss Chicago?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Yeah, I'll miss it. Of course I'll miss it. I've been here my whole life. I'm nervous, but I think being nervous is a good thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You got to be nervous, man. You got your own show. You got your show. You broadcast out of the sports book in the hotel, right?
The South Point Hotel, yeah. And if you're wondering at home, yeah, SiriusXM 204, and you can watch for free on VSIN.com, VSIN.com. So check it out. Love your support.
It's amazing, man, to not only get your own show and to watch you grow. I mean, you obviously were already maturing before I even got here, but to be in a position where you are now going to be doing a radio show, a sports radio show out of a book in Vegas. I mean, it's pretty cool, man.
Pretty soon, I'll just be wearing a tracksuit and chains. And a
Who
pinky
says you're
ring.
Not right now?
Oh, come on. You can watch right now on the website, WGNRadio.com. I got a suit on. I'm going to trade in all my suits and sport coats for just track suits.
Well, I can't thank you enough, man, for being available to the show and
thank
being a
you.
Friend. And, you know, we're going to miss you here in Chicago. Sam Panionovic leaving WGN Radio to go westward to the city of sin, Las
I'm
going to
miss Rob Martier, too.
And, of course.
Miss you too, big guy.
And you said, as you said, you already, I want it on the record, there is a couch available when I come out.
Yes, that way. Nice black leather sectional.
Yes.
There's room for you and
that's
Pete.
That's all I need. That's all Pete and I need.
Cool.
All right, good to see you, buddy.
Thank
good
you.
Luck.